Pete, have you seen the new edition biop? Am I the only biopic? Am I the only one that really sat down? Brian Altman said he watched.
I missed that one.
Too bad, man. So good. If you watched out there, let me know what you thought of it. 312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman here. It's a download. With you till 11 o'clock tonight here on WGN 720. Looking forward to the evening. I'm psyched to be here tonight, as you heard us talking with Roe and Anna. Craig Hodges is with me at the big table tonight. How fun is that? The sharpshooter, the amazing three-point shooter, Chicago Heights product. Come back in studio to talk about his memoir, Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. I was a huge Bulls. Who isn't? You know what I mean? And it's very interesting when you read his memoir. And you think about, you know, I think about all the kids in the playground in my neighborhood, and we'd play and we'd all act like we were a different place. I love being Craig Hodges. I get that perfect shot. And then you read the book and you realize everything that was happening behind the scenes when they were winning championships, especially when it comes to Craig's political views and what he was attempting to try and use the platform for. As the Bulls got bigger, Craig Hodges wanted more of the players, including the superstars Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, to make political stand on sort of political platforms, to use the spotlight, if you will, of an NBA Finals to be able to talk about some of the things that were wrong in society. And it hurt him. According to the book, it hurt his livelihood, the idea of trying to speak out, to speak to truth, to be political in a sport. And it's not new. You know, you say what you will about Colin Kaepernick and kneeling and protests that are happening today, but, you know, you go back to an NBA of the 70s, 60s and 70s, whether it be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Oscar Robertson, even Bill Walton to an extent, making political statements while they were playing basketball. Craig Hodges comes from that. He played with Bill Walton. He had a lot of rearing from some of the veterans when he came in as a rookie. So we'll talk with Craig Hodges. Jack Silverstein will be here too, our unofficial statistician, who is an NBA, sort of our Chicago Bulls historian. He will also be here to help with the interview. That's coming up at the big table, 8 o'clock. 7:30, though, you know what we got to do. Touche tonight. What a night for Touche. Again, I sent the email out this morning saying, hey, Chris, hey, Dave, are you guys ready for tonight? What should we talk about? I think the chain is still going. Like, just every 5 minutes it gets updated. There's a lot to talk about. And I think, you know, I heard a little bit of WGN talking about this today. It seems like we're in a new zone where it's going to be a 24/7 news cycle with President Trump and his administration. We're not going to get any days off. There's no golfing, maybe mini golfing, no golfing, though. So that's what we're going to get. And so it almost feels like the Touche segment that we've been doing for a year is even more perfect, relevant, if you will, every Monday because of the action that happens on the weekends. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio coming up at 7:30. Later tonight, two women who are starring at Second City, Shantira Jackson and Sejal Yoshi, will be in studio. We'll talk about their two shows, Main Stage and ETC. As you know about Second City, it has become not only a place that has sold out shows and has been an unbelievable experience if you're coming to Chicago. Even if you live here, you live in the suburbs, or you're a tourist from other places, Second City is a must. It's a go-to. I mean, you think of all the concierges downtown, the hotels, they're like, you got to go see Second City if you can get in, right? And it has been a launching pad for a lot of different careers. And beyond that, it also serves, and I think about it now more than ever, as a place that at all levels of American entertainment, you're finding people who trained and actually performed at Second City contributing, whether it be at the writer's table, whether it be producing, whether it be acting. There's a lot that you can do in Hollywood, and it seems more and more people that are coming out of Second City come straight from the stages to jobs in American entertainment. So we'll talk with two women who are on stage now at Second City. We'll talk about what their careers look like, how they got here, but also how difficult it is in the moment, in a new world, with a Trump administration. You've seen in the last 6 months headlines Second City's got about audiences being much more emboldened to say racist things, misogynistic things, awful things. Yeah, shout it out in improv sets. Make things, the heckling becomes much, much more difficult to maintain. We've talked about it, or maintain, to handle. We've talked about it on this program before with other Second City veterans, and we'll talk to two people who live it every single day coming up. And also tonight, and I'm excited about this. This is going to be great. To live in Studio 435 tonight, the Golden Horse Ranch Band. We're going to do a little square dancing. That's right. The Thalia Hall 12th Annual Barn Dance Apocalypse is upon us. And we're going to do some square dance. Are you excited? I think you're excited.
There's a fifth grade gym coming back.
Really is. I think it's amazing, like, you know, to be one of the places, one of the radio stations in this town that sort of started the barn dance. We go back to the barn dance vibe here at Studio 435 tonight. So a lot to do tonight here on the download. News, weather, and traffic with Veronica Carter and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, we got a big show tonight, so let's get it on the road. Let's start with the carryout here on 720 WGN. This is where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Well, today the Trump administration commented on the travel ban. You know what they said? They said, all is going well. Protesters continue to march on America's airports and huge crowds turn out in London and throughout the UK, or as the kids say, global. What's next? Well, according to Trump, nothing. He's moved on and left the rest of us to argue on Facebook. Some people argue that this is what Trump was elected to do, to secure our safety by any means necessary. Others argue that a travel ban is atrocious because to stop incoming terrorists, you've gone against the very values that terrorists want to take away. This is tough because I've tried to be objective, understand the issue as much as I can, and I get that the countries that are on the list have a beef with us, and terrorists do train there. And they're probably pretty angry since we've been bombing select countries via drones for the last 15 years. But I also know that the countries that we're talking about are huge. There are millions of people that look at America as the land of the free, home of the brave. They like us, and they're regular people with no political agenda, no desire to hurt anybody. They just want a fresh start. Or maybe to run from something, drones. So we are punishing many for the actions of few, which really sounds like something we learned in grade school. I thought the best point was made by Steve Bertrand and Bill and Wendy today. If you use the logic applied by the Trump administration and reverse it, Paris, France could easily be like, we don't accept people from Chicago because they have a serious gun violence problem. We don't know if you're going to bring guns in. We don't know anything about you. You might murder all of us. No thanks. And before you say, that would never happen. It just did. Some thought that the country's anxiety over the travel ban would force President Trump to announce the Supreme Court earlier than expected to divert the media's attention. Well, that's true. That seems to be the case since Trump has decided to make the announcement tomorrow instead of Thursday. And he's addressing the nation with the nomination, which I think is a first. Usually it's done by press release or maybe announcing in the Rose Garden. Nope, Trump takes to mainstream television to do what he does best. Compete with The Bachelor? I wish he would do it by Facebook Live like he does his weekly addresses, you know, but instead do it handheld. Take a look, all the cool things in my room, until he's interrupted by Melania. Melania, get out! I'm showing all my friends in a really rocky, bumpy kind of handheld way. Where's Governor Rauner in all this? He did put out a statement while he's been at a three-day retreat for Republican governors put on by the Koch brothers. The issues that the influential conservative fundraisers are focusing on? Criminal justice. Yeah, I didn't know the Koch brothers were building prisons. But back at home, thousands of protesters swarmed O'Hare Airport as Homeland Security held some travelers in limbo who had already boarded planes. No, no gov, so although there's probably no G's to drop in travel ban, so I can understand why he wasn't there. But the mayor was. Mayor Emanuel was at the airport. He's been critical of the president and the travel ban. He says that he would host refugees at his north side house. Poor refugees. Imagine what that's like. Hey, you guys heard the new Wilco? It's great. You guys like kale? No, it's great. Let me make him a smoothie. Mm. Sony took a $1 billion write-down today. I'm sorry. For the commoners, that just means they're taking a non-cash goodwill impairment charge. What? There's nothing confusing. Guys, keep up with me. I understand that we live in difficult times, but you have to do a better job of educating yourself. You need to know what non-cash goodwill impairment charge. Okay, I don't know what it means either. I read this story 5 times. I guess it means Sony didn't make as much money as they thought they were going to make. No, they're telling us? Cool. A barista robot was introduced at a San Francisco coffee shop, and yep, he's really fast. The robot can make hundreds and hundreds of lattes faster than a human barista, which are worrying opponents of automation, but no word on whether or not the robot can spell. What is your name? It's Brendan. Brandon. No, Brendan. Brandon. No. In weather, what was that blinding gold sphere we saw this morning? What was that? That was crazy. It lit up my whole room. Well, the sun, is that what you call it, the sun? It's been gone from the Chicago area for a record straight 8 days, longest in 25 years, but it quickly went away. So now all that's left is that whitewash slash gray everywhere. The official color of cold. In sports, why don't we lead with the Northwestern Wildcats, huh? The Cats are ranked. They came in at number 25 in this week's AP poll after they made short work of the Hoosiers from Indiana. The Wildcats are now 18-4. To put that in perspective, if they lost the rest of their games, they'd still be a bubble team. So that's awesome. Here comes some stiff competition, though. Purdue, who lost to Nebraska this weekend. Wisconsin and Maryland, all ranked in the top 25. Funny about the AP top 25, they released it today, and it was online. And usually, you know, it shows each team, and it puts their logo next to the team. So it says Florida, and it shows the Gator, and it shows what arrow up and down. Northwestern was 25, and it just said the word Northwestern. Like, they had no, they're like, I don't even know if they have a logo. I've never heard of this school. They've never been here. This is brand new. What do we do? Just type in Northwestern. What font? I don't know what font. That's ridiculous. You know you've had a long drought in collegiate sports when they can't even do a Google search for your logo. They're like, I don't even know where to look. The Bulls won a game at home last night against the 76ers, who were without their star Joel Embiid. You know it's bad when everyone's pumped after a win at home against the 76ers without Joel Embiid. Give me a break. The Bulls now head out on the road to play the Thunder, Rockets, and the Golden State Warriors. This 6-game road trip could either be the beginning of something great or the end of something terrible. Or they go 3-3. You know they're going to go 3-3 and be like, we don't know what to do. Oh, the conventions are over now, and the Cubs and Sox are looking down the barrel of spring training starting up 2 weeks. The Cardinals? Well, they're going to be a little lighter in the pocketbook, losing $2 million and 2 draft picks for hacking the Houston Astros computer system a couple years back. To their defense, they just wanted to know who they were emailing. Who you hanging out with? Who you always emailing? I thought we were tight. That's the carry out for January 30th, 2017. Hey, you know what we want to do? We want to give you a lot of salt tonight. It's cold. We'll make sure you don't slip. There's like 40 salt packets in the bag. All right, coming up, Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling. They're going to be in studio for Touche. This is going to be a good one. Week 2 of the Trump administration. Right here, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Veronica Carter, how was the weekend?
Short.
Did you work this weekend?
Well, yeah, I work here on the weekends.
Oh, man, they don't even give you... You were here Friday night.
Thursday night and Friday night for Rob, because he's pretty sick.
Oh, really?
His kids brought home a bunch of germs, I guess.
Oh, no.
Whole family was sick.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that Rob is so aware that he could take the day off and not get us all sick. I'm the worst. If I get sick, I'm like...
I always just say, I could just get through my air shift.
Yeah, right.
And breathe all over the microphone that somebody else has to breathe on later. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm glad that there are people like Rob, because I would show up and I would get the whole place.
I know. And I write stories on that. I interview doctors and they say, stay home if you're sick. And then I still go to work. Yeah. Like I'm so indispensable, I guess.
You write that story while you're sick?
Yes.
I just got to make it. All right.
That paycheck is good. That's the problem.
Yeah, right. That is always the problem.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Touche. We go right and we go left. Every Monday here on 720 WGN, the download brings you Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling as they spar over issues of national political importance.
Boom! I'm ready to spar, baby.
Touche.
Touche.
This weekend gave us plenty to talk about. Why don't we start right away with the travel ban, the executive order that was brought down on Friday. Mass protests over the weekend.
Well, I was there.
New top.
New top. What do you mean new top?
New top.
The new top is that the acting assistant attorney general of the United States, the acting attorney general of the United States, an Obama holdover, has announced her refusal to defend the president's order in court.
Yes, she ordered her
45 minutes.
She ordered her folks not to defend it. She said, "We do not believe this is lawful. So do not defend
this
in court."
Well, no, she didn't. What she said
You could
was,
argue whether she should have said it,
no,
but that
no,
is
no,
what
no.
she said.
No, what she said is, "We're here to do what's right and actions consistent with our values and what's right, and I'm not going to defend this until it's proven to my satisfaction that this is correct.
I was going to say, lawful. I mean, would you, when you're thinking about executive orders of
that
this magnitude,
so.
and there's going
to
be legal, there's legal question every executive order that comes out, and this is something we saw with Obama, wouldn't you want to have your attorney general in place and confirmed and ready to go to?
Maybe, maybe not. But what she has done is itself an outrage. And frankly, she should be fired. She won't be fired because she's too tiny to fire at this point.
No, that's not why. Tell her the real reason. Tell our audience the real reason she won't be fired.
I think she will not be fired because to fire her is to ascribe significance to her, which she does not deserve.
This is not the real reason. The real reason she won't be fired, Chris, is that she's the only one who can legally sign off on FISA court applications and warrants. You can't do the surveillance if you don't have somebody legally who can sign off, and you can't have somebody legally who can sign off until they're confirmed by the Senate. That's why she won't get fired.
Well, see, she also...
But it's amazing this is happening.
It's awful that this is happening. And now, look, there is a time for people to resign on principle or to be fired on principle, as Attorney General Richardson and Deputy Attorney General Ruckelshaus did in the Saturday Night Massacre, which, of course, I remember as a terrifying moment in American democracy. But then, of course, there's a time for people...
You ain't seen nothing yet, baby.
But then there's a time for people to act on principle, which is what Bork did, because as he said at the time and as he maintained in his fascinating little book on the subject of Saturday Night Massacre, if he had not acted, the constitutional order itself would have been impaired. Okay,
so. Are we going to see more of this kind of stuff? Are we going to see, I mean, we've seen governors and senators kind of step out of line. We've seen Donald Trump tweet at senators and saying, you know, for shame, that kind of thing. Are we going to see more elected officials and appointed officials sort of step up to the Trump administration?
So, first of all, I would be remiss if I didn't share this with you. So, on Saturday, as soon as I heard about that they were excluding green card holders, permanent residents of the United States, which is what green card holders are, I was mortified. I was outraged. And for all the talk that the Trump people have and that Breitbart put out a story saying, oh, these protests at airports are being done, organized by CARE, the Committee on American Islamic Relations. No, they're being organized and spontaneously happening because people like me, and actually I was texting with J.B. Pritzker, who may be running for governor anyway.
Plug.
But I was texting with JB and
Bruce Rauner is the governor and he's running for re-election.
Yes, and where was he, Chris? Funny you should mention that.
He was
cavorting
with
the Koch brothers.
Yeah. He was
when he
how
should
to get
have been
some
standing
for
up
Illinois.
For the rights of Illinois.
He was trying to get
anyway,
some energy
so,
for Illinois.
So
of
I was texting with JB and we basically were like, this is unbelievable. He's the great grandchild of immigrants who were escaping pogroms in Russia. I'm the grandchildren of immigrants who were escaping persecution in Poland and Romania. And we looked at this going like, this is not our country. And so we went out to O'Hare and we protested and helped in whatever minimal way that we could.
And it was
very minimal. This is
you're really anti-protest there,
outrage.
Mr. Roebling. Jeez.
This is an outrage. This is an offense.
Is an outrage. I want to tell you, it goes right at the Trump brand. And I what was even more astounding after this whole unfolding of events, which David relates with due self-regard. you get this article in the Wall Street Journal today. I don't know if you guys saw it, that this had been, quote, planned, unquote, for weeks, if not months, and they still screwed it up so badly.
Well,
and
they planned because they planned it by excluding the head of Homeland Security and
let's get rid of the people who
implementation
know what
they're doing. There's been a lot of criticism about
it's been
the
awful.
Implement.
It's been a miserable failure, and I want to say I have consistently for the last 12 weeks, whatever, since he got elected, said he has three problems. And his problems, I have said, are conflicts, details, and
the third one,
the Department of Energy. Right?
Oops.
Conflicts, details,
and the Department of Energy.
Yeah.
And the Department of Energy. And to that list, I'm now adding competence. Because if he cannot be consistently competent, then the central assertion of his campaign, I'm not a politician, politicians are windbags who never get anything done. I am a successful business. When I come to a city, I leave a 90-story building in my wake. That shows I can get things done. Well, the 90-story building is here, and it's not falling over. But this whole policy formulation and then implementation has been
but Chris,
utter disaster.
You've done, I mean,
impulse
how
control
does,
was your other
impulse
both
control.
Of you guys
Thank
have been
you,
involved yeah. in politics and government yeah. in different phases. How does if this has been planned for weeks and months, how does it get to the point where it kind of stumbles out of the gate? Is it all politics?
That's
I mean, what is it?
No, it stumbles out of the gate when you exclude the professionals who need to be in the room. And that's exactly what happened here. There's a story about General Kelly, the Homeland Security Secretary, who was given a copy of the final executive order to review, and he was on an airplane reviewing it when the press conference came out with, or not the press conference, but the press event came out with Donald Trump announcing the executive order. In other words, the guy had no time to review it, and it just happened.
Okay, so
that's not how you govern.
And here is another way of saying what David just said. This is lousy, capital L, lousy staff work. And the person who is responsible here is Reince Priebus.
Mm.
All right.
That's not good for Priebus.
Here
is
the basic theory is the chief of staff is responsible for both what comes into the president's office, what comes onto his desk, what comes to his hand, or what he's hearing and seeing in a briefing. And then the chief of staff is responsible for executing the decision that is made by the president.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break because I think it's a great stopping point to say there are other issues that we've had with people that are surrounding the president. Steve Bannon comes to mind with the National Security Council. Do you run the risk when you have these loyal people around you, whether it be a brother or a son-in-law or someone that worked on your campaign that doesn't have experience in government and you're seeing sort of the trip up, the stumbles out of the gate because they're not as experienced? Is that something that Donald Trump has to figure out in his early part of his Trump administration? Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, touche here on The Download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
You go right, you go right. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in for Touche. We do this every Monday night. Sort of assess and argue about national politics. Let's get to National Security Council. Unprecedented to have Steve Bannon up there, especially when I was reading a great story about how George W. Bush didn't let Karl Rove in. Right. Other have made it clear to separate issues of national importance with politics. Adding Steve Bannon to the National Security Council and taking out the Joint Chiefs of Staff and taking out intelligence, does that say, does that change the what we've known in the history of American politics or American government?
I don't like it. I don't like it. And I'll tell you, even though Bannon served valiantly by all accounts in the you know, armed forces, I that doesn't qualify him to be in that chair and at all of those meetings. It's really should be the opposite. The Joint Chiefs should be at every meeting, and Bannon should be one of the guys who's listed as when necessary. And here's why. The brilliance of the founders relative to the Constitution was that only Congress can declare war. And for Congress to do something, it is innately and inherently and appropriately political. And folks need to understand that when you are going from responding, not responding to a crisis, but if you're getting into a major conflict, you have to have some sense, is the country, one element in the calculus, is the country prepared to support this position to the extent of losing lives and spending treasure? That's a political question, and therefore there is some justification. But I don't like Bannon being in on every meeting and the Joint Chiefs being excluded or being there only when called.
David Axelrod wrote a column at CNN.com today saying, I woke up this morning as an alternative fact. Sean Spicer is demonstrating that the Stephen Colbert quality of truthiness in his press briefings. And one of the things he cited, he said, oh, David Axelrod would walk in and out of National Security Council meetings all the time. And David Axelrod responded, no, that never happened. What happened is that there were a couple of circumstances when we were preparing for the bin Laden raid when I was allowed to sit in and listen. And that is it. That is a far cry from being a member of the Principals Committee. Mm. And again, having Bannon there, who, by the way, ran a website that considered itself the home of the alt-right. That was his what he said about that website, Breitbart. Having Bannon there and kicking out the director of national intelligence and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they're not kicked out as in they can't come into these meetings, but they're no longer a member of the principals committee that are automatically included in every meeting. It's dumbfounding because Trump is justifying this outrageous executive order on refugees and green cards and immigration by saying this is all about safety, security, safety, security, safety, security. And yet you make the single most reckless security decision, national security decision to date, which is to kick out your DNI and your chairman of the Joint Chiefs and put in your political guys. It's unbelievable. And honestly, Justin, the question is this incompetence, as Chris talked about earlier, or is it malevolence?
That's a great question. That should be the rest of our convo here. I think the American people are questioning on either side of your political lens, but is it incompetence or is there something more nefarious at play?
I don't think that there is, but you know what? We now have a ticking time bomb for Donald Trump. And I believe that if this thing goes past the 91 days he's got this 90-day, 60-day formula. So we're looking at less than 6 months, and we're looking at countries like Iraq, where it's hard to imagine countries in the world with governments that are more closely interwoven with our own. So let's just take Iraq for a second. If Iraq is not off of this list, which was created by the Obama administration, not by Trump, and that ought to be kept in mind. And that's another failure of this whole thing. They haven't communicated properly about what this thing is, so guys like David can misrepresent it. But what you have here is, if he's not going to get countries off of that list and they're going to languish and they're going to just get into this sort of extended period of timeout, then people are going to have a basis to say, more is going on here than was originally said. Now, some country, Iran is defying this thing. They're saying, which is it's a terribly, I would say, heartbreaking story for folks who are cleared into the United States and who have met all of the sort of tripwires you're supposed to meet, and then they get excluded. And in some cases, this is tearing families apart. Not in a lot, but in
quite a few. I mean, what they're doing with what they're a couple hundred. Those are real people, real families.
I know.
When I was at O'Hare on Saturday night, they were one of the people that the lawyer was telling me about was There was a couple. They both have green cards. He was still in this country. She had gone to visit a sick relative and had come back with her 9-month-old baby. They have green cards. They're legal. They're legally entitled to work and live in the United States. And they had a 9-month-old baby, and they were held in detention at O'Hare for 12 hours.
Right.
Now, you please tell me what justification they had. And one of the reasons, and this gets into the competence versus malevolence question, when they implemented the order, they didn't give clear direction to the folks at the airports around the country. They didn't know what to do.
Yeah, that's part of the stumbling out of the gate.
But it's still going on. There are 40 people now at O'Hare.
Being held?
That
Chris,
were held
let me
today,
ask you this, because you know we've done Touche for a year. You now went through the primary. You weren't a Trump guy, but you got behind him, and you talk about the conservative values that he somewhat represents. And I'm interested because you will hear on the different media channels that Trump voters support a travel ban. They think this is what
I did not vote for Trump,
but he campaigned on this. My point being that he campaigned and he won the election.
Oh, let me tell you, middle America doesn't care at all about the 200 people. I mean, I don't think it's affecting his base. Frankly, I think the more people are protesting, the more David and JB are going out there passing out Pritzker for governor lapel pins or whatever the hell it is. Going out. I mean, George Soros is throwing $100 bills away, you know, to quote Shel Silverstein.
And he didn't give me one.
So that's all good for Trump, and they're playing into his...
Yeah, I'm not so sure. Donald Trump, if you looked at his approval ratings from the moment he became, he actually was sworn in as president to today, he has set a brand new record for the fastest new president in polling history to go to an upside-down approval rating where more than 50% of the voters disapprove of him.
Well,
and
the line,
Chris, is a straight line. It is still going up.
And let me tell you...
By the way, the previous record was 630 days.
This
was eight.
The situation with competence, I believe, is at the heart of that. I mean, people did not elect him to... goof these things up.
That's what government usually does.
They thought he was going to get these things right.
Right.
And
that's what
he ran
on. He ran, I'm gonna drain the swamp and I'll get things done because these PC politicians and their gridlock and
they're all talk, no action.
Talk, no
he
action.
Ran on
the
a platform
action.
Of I'm gonna shake up Springfield and bring a businessman's sensibility
Would
to run government. Oh wait, sorry, wrong
for,
state.
Stop shilling.
Oh
for
please,
JB.
I've been saying that long before JB was even thinking about
all
this.
All right.
Anyway, let me
But it is the same premise, by the way. The notion and people like me have said to people like Chris, it is not the same thing to run a business as to run a government. And so the notion that
I agree.
We're only 8 days in. I want to make something clear that, I mean, there's still a long way to go. I think that some people will say, and a lot of people will say, I mean, tomorrow's a big day. The Supreme Court nomination, doing it live on television, which is kind of unprecedented to do it in that form to the nation, and a little bit narcissistic in the way that I have brought this nominee. Just do it like everybody else, just once. But anyway, I digress. The point
that
being that
not,
every
the narcissism
single...
sweepstakes was won by Obama.
Oh,
58,000 times over.
Yes, all those buildings with Barack Obama's name on them.
Okay, but my point being that, like, we're 8 days in.
Pull an Obama tape and count
it's
them.
It's 10 days.
Every 10 days. Every single issue that Trump, it seems to be met with criticism. Tomorrow is a big one. Is there momentum off of will senators and congressmen, will they see momentum, Democratic senators and congressmen, off of the fervor that's been created from some of the executive orders when it comes to a Supreme Court nominee?
I think the people in the streets, both of the Women's March and then what's happened, the spontaneous response to this order, if it's not giving Democratic legislators backbone, then they should quit today. Because this president is going to do things. We need to develop a new vocabulary for the word unprecedented, because this president is going to do things in ways that have never been done before. And I don't mean that in a good way. And Democrats need to recognize that you cannot just roll out the red carpet. Now, mind you, I was not going to suggest and would never have suggested you don't vote for Mattis or you don't vote for even Elaine Chao, Mitch McConnell's wife. who is a cabinet secretary, but others like Jeff Sessions, if a Democrat vote for Jeff Sessions, that person should be primaried. It is outrageous. Jeff Sessions will not enforce the laws of this country.
We only got a minute left. What should we expect from this week?
The second week of the Trump impeachment. I think what we're looking at here is a situation in which the establishment is using all levers at its disposal to leverage opposition to Trump. And I think that's been true since the day he got elected. And so everything that we saw from the election to the inauguration was delegitimization. And everything since he became president has been opposition. Now, Trump has done things. And sometimes when you do things, you've got people who say, oh, I'm glad you did that. And you did that and you're a stupid idiot for doing it. So as he does things, he's going to mount up opponents. But I'm not sure. My point about this whole immigration announcement is that unlike the other things he has done and unlike what he's going to do tomorrow night, he will reinforce his base. But with this implementation and the kind of chaos that David was talking about and the possibility of malevolence, because the American people are not malevolent, that has gone to his core. That has gone to his claim of competence, and that is potentially diminishing of his base.
Watch in the next few days, because I know we're out of time for the segment, but watch in the next few days the Russia story. Because
could come back
because he talked to Putin on over the weekend on Saturday and apparently didn't even bother to talk about the Russian interference in the U.S. election. Forget the delegitimization question. Russia intentionally tried to interfere. And in fact, Russia has arrested several key people
to try to keep
them away from U.S. investigators. Yeah. But in any event, they've arrested them. That story, I suspect, is going to blow up this week.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, it is Touche every Monday night here on the Download 720 and WGN. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Veronica. It's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, The Download, with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with Chantira Jackson and Sejal Joshi, two actresses on stage at the Second City. They are both respectively one on the main stage, one on the ETC stage. We'll talk about their careers, how they got there, and what they're going to be doing on stage and after in their careers. Also tonight, we'll do a little square dance. That's right. In Studio 435, live music tonight, where we're going to do a little hoedown. We're giving some country music in the studio, so that'll be fun. It's really great. Jack Silverstein's in studio. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, Justin.
Jack, of course, the unofficial statistician for The Download, and also, I would say, our NBA, our Bulls historian on the program. He's also the author of How the GOAT Was Built. Great, great book about the 96 team, the Chicago Bulls team that was the greatest of all time, although our guest here may disagree.
and has quite a perspective and a right to disagree.
Well, we've got him for the whole hour, so maybe we'll ask. My next guest is a champion. There aren't too many people in Chicago that wouldn't recognize Craig Hodges on the street, good old number 14. Not only played a pivotal role in the Bulls' first championship run, but he also brought us a sense of civic pride when he would win the three-point contest at the All-Star Game over and over, years after year.
year after year.
Craig Hodges is also known as a politically outspoken athlete, one who famously wore his all-white African dashiki to the White House. And was it politics that ended Hodges' career? Whether it was being outspoken about race or trying to convince Michael Jordan to be more conscious about the struggles of the black community, Hodges makes a strong case for being blacklisted by the NBA. The Chicago Heights product just put out his memoir called Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter, and he is in studio tonight. Mr. Hodges, great to see you. Great to meet you.
Appreciate you, man. Thanks for the invite.
All right, so Jack and I, you know, well, Jack knows a lot more about the Bulls than I do, but I was... I didn't know that you grew up in the area. I mean, NBA, especially with you know, people who come through, they're not always here. But Chicago Heights, right. Talk about Chicago Heights and growing up in the Chicago, right outside of Chicago, between here and Indiana. Yeah.
For me, it was, you know, it was a blessing, man, especially when I think in terms of my development and growth as a student athlete. My granddad was a mentor for a lot of young men in the South Suburbs and as far as sports and the like. And growing up in a household where academics, you know, was p- paramount, and that the only way you would get to play was to make sure that you was academically correct. So from an early age, I loved to read and write. And as I grew older, I understood how much impact sport could play in my life. And mm-hmm. I took it serious, but I still had fun. And I still, to this day, consider, you know, my upbringing. And I thank my grandpops who's passed away, and I just thank my family and those who've had an impact on my life from that standpoint. And Chicago Heights was a great place to grow up, man. I wouldn't change it for the world. At that point when we were growing up, you know, we had programs, so there were summer things to do, where today there's a lot more distractions than what we had growing up.
One of the things about in reading your book was about how politically active your family was, to the point of going to the Freedom March and really getting to understand the teachings of Martin Luther King.
Right. And my mom especially. My mom was the secretary for the civil rights movement in our area. So for me, from the time I could remember, I was sitting next to her because it wasn't a babysitter at that time. I was sitting there in the meetings with her. And to see active, live leadership at six, seven, 8 years old. And then when I was an eight-year-old, I can remember coming in the house and Dr. King had just got assassinated. So to see the impact that had on my mom and my grandmom, and to see them cry like I'd never seen them cry before, I think that put an imprint on me as far as knowing how important his life was. And for me, to this day, I still continue to study what he brought to the table as far as the information that he left behind and the spirit in which he moved, and try to, you know, see if any way we can capture that in any way possible that I can use it to go forward and teach.
You know, for you, I mean, we bringing it back to basketball in Chicago Heights. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's when you learned that you could play the game.
No question.
And Jack, I know you and I talked offline just about, you know, what makes Craig Hodges Craig Hodges is his shot. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's unbelievable how technical and how precise it is.
Yeah, and one of the things that interested me, and I think that will really interest Bulls fans, is that I don't know how many Bulls fans know that Tex Winter coached you in college and understand that that association, that relationship goes well before you arrived in Chicago with the Bulls in 1989, and the way that he shaped you. And it sounds to me from reading the book that he shaped you both as a basketball player, teaching you the three F's, the foundation of shooting, and then as well as a man. What did you learn from a basketball standpoint that was most important from Tex? Mm-hmm. And what did you learn as a life standpoint most important?
Going back to the question previous as far as shooting, and for me, I grew up shooting on Gavin school ground, and there wasn't a net. And so when I think about shooting a basketball now and the quality of the way that I shot, I think about those days when I was shooting when it was twilight, when I couldn't shoot from the front because you couldn't really see the rim. So and that's why I shot from the corners so well, because I shot from the corners all the way through life at 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night when all I could see was the rim from the side. So I would shoot at that rim in the dark. So now when it was light, the corners were no issue. And going forward, when Tex recruited me when I was probably a junior in high school at Rich East, and like I told him then, man, I want to go somewhere warm, man. I'm tired of these winters. I don't know where that warm. I don't know what type of program it would be basketball wise. But UCLA at that time was the mainstay, and I was a John Wooden, you know, fanatic. So I wanted to go to UCLA growing up, and Tex. When my senior year, we had the City Suburban All-Star Game, and we played against the City, and I had a pretty good game, and Tex recruited me after that point, telling me, I just got the job at Long Beach. And I told him right there, where do I sign? He's like, no, Craig, you got to take a visit. No, I don't, man. Just give me the paper before you sign somebody else.
That's great. So one really interesting part of the book where you're talking about what Tex taught you is the two-ball trick.
Right.
This idea that you shoot one ball at a time, but in reality, two fit in the rim.
No question at all.
At any one time.
Absolutely. And the critical part of it, Tex taught us, you know, two balls can fit in at one time, so you can never say that you're in a slump.
All right.
So you should be able to put one in and be able to try to put that one where those two coincide and intersect. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of things that he taught me about shooting, and one of the things that he taught me was how important it is to get your arch out at the basket. When I was in high school, man, I shot 56% from the floor my senior year, and probably 75% were from 20 feet or more. But I was shooting a line drive, man. I, to this day, I don't know how I shot that percentage when I think about the trajectory of my shot and being able to work with Tex for 4 years and crystallize the importance of holding your follow through and getting the ball out at the basket. Taught me a lot, man.
Well, we'll talk about your time with Tex Winter, especially, you know, here in Chicago, coming up here after the break. The guest tonight at the big table, Craig Hodges, his book, Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. He's in studio tonight along with Jack Silverstein. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More Craig's story. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table is Craig Hodges, longtime great Chicago Bull. He's got a memoir out, Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. I'm joined by Jack Silverstein, the author of How the GOAT Was Built, which is really about the 1996 team. Craig, you got a problem with that premise.
Well, you know, my premise is that in order to get all those other championships, we had to get that first one. And I think the struggles, similar to the struggles and triumphs of our team, because to go through the battles that we went through with Detroit, I think, gave us a certain wherewithal where I don't think anybody could have beat us, that team. So whether it was the teams after us or the teams before us, I think our mental toughness and approach to playing the game was such that when we got a lead, we weren't going to relinquish it. And we never were going to get behind out of the gates because MJ wasn't going to allow that.
Yeah.
And then our tenacity as a bench unit was such that we ain't going to let these guys get back in the game once they go out. So
it's interesting because you've had an NBA career much before you came to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Talk about that transition of playing, you know, being a kid who was at Long Beach State, mm-hmm. but, you know, being from Chicago Heights and
right.
playing on, where you're on Milwaukee, you're on right, Phoenix, you're right. on other places before you came to Chicago.
Exactly. And I think that lent itself to when I got to Chicago, I was ready as a professional. I was ready to handle being at home, handle tickets, and handle saying no about I ain't got no tickets, you know, and that type of stuff. Compared to younger in my career, I think it would have been a lot of distractions that I wouldn't have been able to handle and not have been as impactful a player as I was when I got here. But I think the Milwaukee experience gave me a certain realization of what it meant to be a professional.
How
playing,
so?
Playing under Don Nelson, playing with a superstar, Sidney Moncrief, Terry Cummins, Paul Pressey, guys who, you know, really Terry and I, we got traded into Milwaukee, and when we got there, we saw that it was a certain culture, and that culture involved mad work. And our defensive principles were such that no team was going to be in better condition than a Don Nelson team. And he was crazy at that point in his career compared to what he was when he got to the Warriors and out west and just let them play ball. Ours was more of a disciplined unit. And I respected that because when we went into games, we knew that we had shut down defense if we needed to stop.
What was the impact of you going against Jordan before you joined the team? Because obviously a lot of young guys who were on that team were drafted by the Bulls. All they knew was Jordan.
Right.
But you were used to going head-to-head with him, and you always talked about the ways in which you weren't afraid.
Right, and I think that was the Milwaukee teams because we played the Bulls in a couple of playoffs and waxed them. So it wasn't a thing of being so much fearful of the image or the majestic MJ, because he wasn't at that point in his career. He was still building that imagery. And I can recall one time we played them in Milwaukee, and we just happened to be going back from the layup lines at the same time, and we meet at half court and give each other dap. And I tell him at that point in time, I say, man, if we ever get together, we're going to win championships. And, you know, 2.5 years later, I was in Chicago, and we were on our way to winning championships.
What was your thought of before you came, when you said, you know, mm-hmm. besides the fact of playing at home,
right?
What was your thought of those Bulls teams? What was your thought of coming to Doug Collins' run Chicago Bulls?
Well,
team?
It was, you know, and it was crazy because Jerry Colangelo grew up in Chicago Heights also. And when I was with Phoenix, the day that he traded me here, he brought me in. He was like, yeah, Hodge, we could use you as insurance guard just in case somebody goes down, but I got an opportunity for you to play somewhere right now. He's like, but I don't know if you want to go. I was like, what's up, Jay? He's like, Chicago wants you right now. You want to go play? I was like, come on, man. He was like, I know. Go ahead and go. But to me, it was just the understanding that Doug was very emotional, and he allowed – if you got on a run, Doug was going to let you roll, and that was the beautiful thing about it. If you made one shot, you got the next two trips down the court, so you could go on a roll where you could score 14, 16 points in a quarter. But that was fun, but it was still something missing. And I think when Phil got the job, he understood what he had over there in Tex, and he gave Tex an opportunity to do what he could do. And that's what I tell people about Phil, is his understanding of managing people and what their qualities are is a big, mm-hmm. big reason of his success.
So one thing I'm interested in, and that I've been interested in for a little while, is this dichotomy in Phil Jackson between mm-hmm. certain parts of his personality and other parts. Like, he exudes wisdom and compassion and mindfulness,
right.
the Zen master mm-hmm. in the 60s and all that. Mm-hmm. And on the same time, he's been on the wrong side of history with black culture and hip-hop on a number of occasions.
No question.
Yeah.
No question.
We talk a lot about, what does Michael Jordan need to do, and is he, you know, being responsible with his fame? But we don't really talk as much about that with Phil Jackson. Is that something that you ever struggled with, seeing him as a player and then as assistant coach?
And see, you understand it. For me, it's fun. It's fun to see, like you say, that dichotomy of, you have endorsement deals that are bigger than a lot of pro athletes. So the Zen is without ego, but it's not without ego when we have those type of deals. So it's a balance, you know, and it's a game going on. It's a game to be played, man. And Phil understands how to play the game in order to do what he needs to do to get teams to play well, as far as when he was coaching, you know. But his struggles in New York, I think, stem from, you know, some organizational things that I had a chance to witness when I was with the D-League team. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think when you look at the cultural aspects, look where Phil came from. He's from you know, a rural area where wasn't many black people around. So right. A lot of your upbringings later in your life, some of them come out not to be so palatable. So some of the things that he said about LeBron, I totally disagree with. I appreciate what he did for us winning championships, but at the same time, when you diss people on something that really shouldn't be handled that way, I can't agree with, man.
The story in the book is mm-hmm. really about how the team came together, especially right. under Coach Jackson.
No question.
The mindfulness was what was missing.
Absolutely.
This concept of playing as a team. Mm-hmm. Talk about your teammates.
For real, you know, when I look at what really brought us together, it was the offense. And up until that point, everybody would stand and watch MJ do his thing. And you might be in rhythm to catch the ball, or you might be out of rhythm based on if he felt like giving it to you out of a double or triple team.
Right,
so
right,
it was based on you being able to read off him, where when the offense was installed in training camp, Scotty, MJ, Horace, they were all, man, this ain't going, oh, man, we ain't this triangle. Dude, I'm telling y'all.
And you knew.
I'm telling them. By January, y'all going to love this. December 15th, man, this is the bomb, man. Because 15 to 20% less energy has to be exerted for MJ in order to get the same amount of buckets. And everybody's able to get involved. And that's the biggest part of the system, I think. And even today, when I look at how many teams aren't trying to use it, that could use it and be – like this team that I'm sitting in this city with right now, that's, I don't know what they're
doing. Why don't teams use it?
You can't use what you don't know.
Because it's such an intricate.
And it's not so much that it's so intricate. It's just a matter of every part of what you're doing goes into it. So if you're not coming out of the locker room in training camp doing it. So when I'm in New York watching Derek Fisher attempt to implement it, and I'm watching all of the wrong things going on. And I'm saying, and I'm watching Phil not really say anything because he's allowing Fish to do his thing, which I understand. But I'm telling Fish, dude, why are we cutting all these corners with the system? Because one thing about it, if you're not implementing it in the first 2 weeks, the NBA season is such where you can't go back and get this.
Is the idea that cutting corners of the triangle has to do with the talent that's there? Some players don't want to play it that way.
That's why I say if you don't know it, you can't teach it. And there's a lot of things that it's not many. Probably myself, Billy McKinney, maybe PJ, Phil Jackson. It's only like three of us that really have been taught it from the master, Tex. And for me, when I look at it, it's the most simplistic thing going because it teaches ball movement, player movement, and spacing. Hmm. Everything that's composed in winning championships. So if you look across the landscape of the last couple champions that have won it, and you look at parts of the system that they use, Golden State, dribble weave, San Antonio, dribble weave, Golden State drawing kicks, all of that's triangle. All of that is triangle.
They're just taking little parts.
And that's the whole thing with the NBA. One of the first lessons I learned is that if something worked against you in a game, you stole it and used it the next game against the next team. So it's all about stealing somebody else's stuff that works.
Right. And the triangle is so simple, seemingly, and yet it has become something that people think they can't handle.
Right. And it's all based upon knowing that you got a strong side and a weak side. Three people on one side, two people on the other, and how do you get them there as undercover as possible and as with the least amount of pressure, so we never fought pressure.
Are we talking about basketball or life here?
Both.
Okay, good. The triangle works for both, right?
No question.
Craig Hodges is my guest. He's the author of Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. Jack Silverstein's also in studio tonight. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back, and let's talk a little bit more about politics and your worldview.
No question.
And we'll go from there. Craig Hodges, my guest tonight at The Big Table. Stay with us. Thanks, Veronica. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Craig Hodges, the great sharpshooter for the Chicago Bulls. Man, I would always, in the neighborhood back in Wonder Lake, Craig Hodges.
I hear you, man.
You be John Paxson. I'll be Craig Hodges.
I appreciate that, man. That's something.
He's the author of Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. Jack Silverstein's also in studio. He's our unofficial statistician and Bulls historian. Here on the download, also the author of How the GOAT Was Built, the story of the 1996 Chicago Bulls. Let's get back to basketball. Mm-hmm. But when we talk with you, Craig, the book is half about basketball and all the great stories behind the scenes of the Chicago Bulls and building a championship. Mm-hmm. But it's also about politics. And it's also about your story of finding a way to use your platform to be able to speak to the issues of the time.
Mm-hmm. And when we were off air, you was talking about the intro to politics and sport on the NBA level. Bill Walton, who I love dearly, who was my mentor and as far as understanding the politics of professional sports, first thing he taught me, he's like, I'm going to make you play a rep because you need to understand what's happening. I was like, yeah, okay, man, I'll do it because I'm a rookie. I'll do anything. Just make sure I'm here. So he said, the thing that you always have to remember is that players are separate from management.
Right.
And I always remember, as a player, that you go down with the players and you stay with the players. And I think for me, that has never changed. Even when I was with the Lakers and player development, I would always make sure that I told Phil, I don't want to be in any meetings when a player is getting ready to get cut, because I don't want to have to go out and work with somebody and then you're going to come out and tell him he has to go after we're working on things to get somebody better. And I think that's the part, for me, it gave me a choice.
You know, you talk about it because early on in your career when you're playing for the Clippers, you got your first check and you're so excited.
Mm-hmm. And no signature.
And there's no signature on the check. Right. And then you check it in and, the owner.
That is a savage Donald Sterling.
And that's the thing when you look at those franchises. And it is like any other business where you have those businesses that are quality within the framework of whether it's accounting or lawyering or whatever you're saying. But it's the thing where the quality of organization from when I was with the Clippers to the Milwaukee Bucks was night and day, and you have different feelings and different spiritual parts of organizations that come through. And I think, to me, the greatest organization that I've had a part to play in, I think, is Los Angeles Lakers, I'd have to say. You know, just the quality of just the quality of care, I'm going to say, that they have respect for realizing that the players matter. And we're going to do a lot to make sure and ensure that the players are ready to play.
Well, let me ask you, Craig, it's a nice transition into the fact that there's a lot to be said about how free agents don't want to come to Chicago and the Chicago Bulls organization is not player-friendly.
Right.
I mean, tell us. I mean, where did the Bulls rank when it comes to the cultures and the organization?
I think now it's kind of low, man, and it's sad. You know, at one point, I think we were a destination city. You know, we're still a destination city from the standpoint of what we have to offer, but I think from a basketball end, it has something to be said when you look at players who don't really want to come here and play. And to be in a town like this where you have a media market, you have – you know, instant credibility if you do what you're capable of doing on the court. So it's odd, but at the same time, when you're not winning, man, and when you don't have a winning attitude to lead out, and I think, you know, to some degree, when Derrick Rose left, some of the spirit left. And when we talk about the spirit, I think Chicago has a lot to offer, especially when I look at fan base and fan support. If you come in and play all right, man, the fans will support you. But if you go out there and you lacking, the city is going, they're not going, you know, really come and support you. And mainly, you know, you're going to get your 19,000 or whatever you get at the United Center, but that's corporate. That's not really grassroots.
Jack and I, when we were getting ready to talk to you, I mean, one of the things that we think about today is a Derrick Rose gets on the court and he wears an I Can't Breathe t-shirt, or Joakim Noah talks about issues, you know, that are not on the basketball. And he's met with a little bit of criticism in Chicago.
Right.
Let's go back to your career.
Right.
You know, predating those guys. Mm-hmm. Talk about when the Bulls were making a run to the championship, and Jack, specifically, you know, you were leading up trying to get the attention of Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and Horace Grant.
Yeah, so this is one of the most striking sections of the book, at least to me. Let me set the stage for listeners. 1991, game one, NBA Finals, Chicago Stadium. It's the Bulls' first championship series.
Absolutely.
It's against the Los Angeles Lakers. You approach the game's two biggest stars, not just in the series, but in the NBA at that point.
Absolutely.
Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, you approach them with a request. What did you ask them?
I felt that was the only time that we have power, is at All-Star Weekend and playoff time. And taking from an example of Jerry West and Elgin Baylor in the 1963 All-Star game, when they called for a work stoppage, I felt that this was a great time for us to call for a work stoppage. And as far as we were trying to get minorities in upper management and on the executive level of the game, and I felt that at that time, 21 of the 24 athletes were black, that if we stood up and say we didn't come out for the first 19, when the clock turned on 19, people would be like, well, they're playing psychological games. 16 minutes, what's going on? 15 minutes, the commissioner would have, Commissioner Stern would have came out and said, what's going on? And I think we don't realize the impact that we have at certain parts and at certain points in our careers, and that we think in terms that, well, I can go ahead and make this bread and I'll come back and visit that issue later,
right?
When you come back to visit the issue later, you don't have the platform anymore.
What did Michael Jordan say?
It's too extreme. He and Magic both. And I can understand when you haven't studied it, so I couldn't.
Haven't studied politics.
You haven't studied the impact of what your career and what you bring to the table. So I liken it to Paul Robeson, and I liken it to, you know, Harry Belafonte and all of the
people who stood up.
People who were in the movement who not only stood, but stood and put their money forth and to help. And if you're capable of doing that, that's fine. But we need sweat equity also. So whatever you can bring to the table, bring that. And that was my position. It's not anything to me any extreme from anybody else that wants to further the condition of their people to get us in a better state, man.
You talk a lot in the book about trying to pull the young Bulls aside and talk about not only political times, but black history.
Right, right.
What was their reaction? What was a Michael Jordan? He doesn't seem, and we've known him for, you know, as media fans, has to be apolitical as somebody who's just a celebrity. And he, talk about your relationship.
That's the beautiful part is that I was blessed to be on the bus, to be in the locker room, to be in the training room when the real conversations are going on. And that, no one's in a vacuum, man. No, this stuff is affecting everybody. Now, the manner in which it affects you is depending on where you're from. Me personally, I grew up in the Heights. I grew up from here. So my perspective was I want my city to do better. And me being a champion here, I can do as much as I can to lift us up. And I think many times when, you know, they would hear me, we would talk, we'd have great conversations. I would give them literature. They would take it, accept it, read it, tell me how cool it is. But to actually go out and let it manifest in what you're doing is something different. And the money has so much of an impact on whether people say anything or not, man. And we can try to play it off, but we know that if certain things are said and they're not palatable, then you can pay a heavy price.
Well, it was a tumultuous time, too.
No question.
The early 90s, you had the first Gulf War.
Yes.
You had Rodney King.
Yes.
You had the Nike boycott.
No
this
question.
Idea of Nike taking advantage or, you know, at least exploiting young black youth when you know, talking about shoe sales mm-hmm. and no black people mm-hmm. were actually working in the company. Mm-hmm.
And so, I know that Phil was very outspoken about those issues in the
right,
locker room, about
right.
asking you guys,
right.
how do you feel about this, you know,
exactly.
about these war efforts? How
exactly.
do you feel about right?
In fact, when the Gulf War jumped off, we were in Orlando, if I recall. And he called us in the huddle, right? Because they said it during right after the national anthem. They said that we're at war. President Bush declared war against Iraq. And a lot of guys came back to the huddle. Man, let's bomb them off the map. Let's all of this kind of stuff. And Phil said, and I quote, that 20 years from now, you're going to have to worry about that same family who got blew off the map, who had a baby that was still alive, that came over here, and they're sitting in a movie theater with a bomb strapped to them. And some of those things came to fruit. But you know, it's one of those things that was a time during that period of time, man, there were so many political issues going on, but we didn't have the luxury of social media. And had that been the case, that different story, man.
We're talking with Craig Hodges mm-hmm. here on The Download. He's got a new book. Jack Silverstein joined us as well. Let's take our last break here,
okay.
and we'll come back. And
sure.
I want to talk about your final days with the Chicago Bulls mm-hmm. and what happened subsequent to the Bulls and
okay.
and the end of your playing career.
Got you.
Craig Hodges,
cool.
my guest. He's the author of Long Shot, Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. All right, in studio with me, Craig Hodges. He's the author of Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter, good old number 14. Jack Silverstein's also here. And we're running out of time, and there's so much to talk about. This book is great.
Thanks, man.
You know, it's interesting because the first time I think that NBA fans, mm-hmm. at least Chicago Bulls fans, were aware of your politics was a visit to the White House
right.
with George
right.
H.W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. You wore the dashiki. Talk about
right.
what you went to the White House, what you wanted to
do. Well, the biggest thing was I had been wearing dashikis for the previous season. So the whole playoff, I wore a dashiki, so it wasn't an issue. In fact, you know, we're ritualistic as players, so everybody asking, Hodge, you got another dashiki? Yo, man, we good to go. We good to go for the whole shebang. But for me, it was just a matter and a cultural imperative that I had been a descendant of slaves and part of my family's Native American. So we've been blessed to be here. And for me, it was just a culmination of being able to thank my ancestors and all those freedom fighters who had given me an opportunity to be able to be here. And then to be able to write the president a letter and go in total respect. I was not disrespectful. I didn't thumb my nose at him and say, nah, man, I ain't going to the White House. But I went as a matter of respect and out of respect to my ancestors and what they blessed me to study, and then to be able to say thank you and let the president know that I'm coming on behalf of people who wouldn't get a chance to come to the White House and would you consider their issues the same way you consider foreign policy.
Yeah.
And what's, I think, doubly interesting about mm-hmm. that happening, that you showed up with a letter mm-hmm. and people said, oh, this is so controversial.
Right.
Michael Jordan didn't show up at all.
Right. Or PAX.
Or PAX. Okay.
Right.
Well, Mike was in South Carolina
right,
playing golf.
Right.
So which is the bigger affront
no
to the
question.
Presidency? And is it showing up with a letter asking for rights, or is it going mm-hmm. to golf?
Right. And the biggest thing, too, is that when we look at the economic impact of Craig Hodges doing what I did was only impactful to me. You know, in my family, if it came out that way towards MJ, you look at all those different corporations that would have to maybe pull the plug on his endorsement. That wasn't going to happen, man. So well, I don't look at it like that.
You know, flash forward to the fast forward to the Portland Trailblazers series, and you know, a lot of media around the Chicago Bulls. Mm-hmm. Second, and the New York Times talked to you and asked questions about civil rights issues, issues that were happening.
Right.
And you spoke frankly, and you even talked about, you know, you wanted Michael Jordan to be more,
all of
vocal.
All of us. And you know, we do a lot of stuff through foundations, through 501c3s, through organizations that keep us anonymous. And that's cool. That's cool. But at the same time, when our condition is what it is, people need to see that we care and that we give a damn. And I think one of the biggest ways to show that is to have a part in this thing, man.
But in this article, and you know, this was during the NBA Finals.
That's right.
The New York Times pulled out the quote that you had something to say about Michael Jordan.
Right.
How did Michael Jordan respond?
And see, that's the wild part, is that MJ would come to me after stuff like that and be like, "Hi, did you see this garbage?" I was like, "Brother, I see it. I'm not sweating it. You know me." And I tell him, "Man, we need help. It's not a matter of nothing that came out in any of them articles was any surprise to him, because everything that we're saying now, he's heard of it before."
Right.
And so from see, that's the biggest thing with our culture right now, is in rap, we have beef. And everybody got to have a beef in order to sell something. And in that beef is the destruction of my community. So I'm not going to allow anybody to start a beef between me and my brother over this stuff that we ain't got no impact on. Because when I look at the bottom line of Brand Jordan or Nike or anybody else, the bottom line is we are consumers in that. And our consumer dollars plays an important impact in that. And that if we can harness our consumer dollar, then I think we can change the condition on the streets.
Well, you know, after that article came out, it was the final game of the NBA Finals. Whatever.
Right, right,
and,
absolutely.
And you didn't play much.
Perfectly timed.
Perfectly timed. you didn't play much in that game. As a matter of fact, that's a game Chicago Bulls fans remember. Another reserve guard and
Bobby Hanson.
Bobby Hanson.
Absolutely, no question.
Another championship
and
for the Bulls.
And I love Bobby, too. That's my boy.
That summer, Jerry Krause gives you a call, says, you know what, we're moving in a different direction.
Absolutely.
Notch.
We're going younger.
What happens next?
You tell me that you thank me for keeping an eye on the young guys, BJ, Hora, Scotty, which I said, I'm not a babysitter, I'm a hooper, but that's another part of the story. And then he says, yeah, we're going to go younger. Then a week and a half later, you hire Trent Tucker, who happens to be probably 4 or 5 months older than Hodge. So, to me, it's just when I look at it, I'm so happy that I'm blessed to be able to look at it in the spirit that I can.
Why not move on to another team?
Well, it's like everything else, man. At that point in time, would nobody touch me? And, you know, Dave Zirin, who wrote the foreword for my book, enlighten me to how many players that he talked to who said they ain't want to be like Hodge. And as far as standing up, and that it could possibly hurt your chance to play any further. And especially the finances that are happening now in the league, man, I can understand why somebody wouldn't stand up. You know, I wouldn't hold it against them. But at the same time, I would tell them that in this social media, you should be able to have a safety net of people who support you to be able to show that, hey, man, you're doing the right thing.
You know, Jack, and you've got a story, too, about the Chicago Bulls players. I mean, a lot of players knew exactly what happened to
No
you.
Question.
They knew that this was more about something else besides off the court than what was on the basketball.
Absolutely.
How did they react? I mean, have you kept relationships with
these
guys?
Well, you know, and it's cool because as we get older, we get wiser. And a lot of young guys that, you know, Scotty, Horace, BJ, they've come to me. You know, I had a chance to sit down with Horace after the TNT, and as well as speak to BJ Armstrong, and they told me how much an impact I've had in as far as what they've studied the last couple of years, and that the stuff that I was studying in 91, they're picking up now. So it's cool to know that, you know, consciousness comes, and to sit down, to have a chance to sit down at dinner with Horace and his son, and him to tell me that he felt that he could have had my back a little bit better. And I told him, man, we were all young at that time, and I was just blessed to have studied something that y'all didn't study. So, you know, thanks for it, and I appreciate the dinner.
And you guys sat for 3 hours. Do you do you see a relationship now moving forward? We have more
Yeah, we've always had a cool relationship, Horace and I. We were always Jordanaires, so and we took those roles to be funny, but at the same time, we were serious about making sure that our team was the best team, and you know, regardless to what went on as far as, you know, him not getting the ball and MJ not giving him the ball when he wants it. He knew that the role that he played was as important as my role, as important as Will produced. So we understood that everybody played a significant role in us winning, and we didn't negate anybody's role in that. And I think my politics and my mindset was just something that helped during those road trips when they were on the plane. Yo, Hodge, what you think about this? And we'd have a conversation that got us to our next airport. So I think all of those stories come together, and it's part of life and life experience.
As we wrap up real quick, the last thing I'd want to ask Craig Hodges, do you recognize, you still in your head, I mean, for everything that happened to you, and you're blacklisted, you didn't play again, you were unceremoniously dropped by the Bulls, do you still feel the love from Chicago Bulls fans?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the beautiful part of it, man, is that I can be in the city and be somewhere and people's like, man, I just want to thank you for what you did, for winning championships and the joy that you gave me and my wife, or the joy that you gave my grandmom, who was a staunch Bull fan. I tell Bulls fans all the time is that, you know, there was never a point when I played here that I didn't feel like I was carrying the whole city into the game behind me. So I knew they had my back, and I knew that they were going to cheer for me. And off the court, it was like, during the time when we was winning, man, our money wouldn't spend in the city. So it was a great thing.
Well, it's a great book. Check it out. Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. The book is, of course, written by Craig Hodges.
Thank you.
Craig, thanks for being here. Jack Silverstein, who has written the book, How the Goat Was Built, story of the 1996 Bulls.
Cool.
Second best
Yes. Right. Yeah. I ain't going to hold it against him, though, man. He's a fellow writer.
Thanks, guys.
God bless and peace to all your listeners, man.
Thanks, Veronica. Big news tonight. The firing of an attorney general. That's unheard of. I guess that means something. We'll talk about it ad nauseum, I'm sure, for the next couple days. But it reminds me of what we said earlier in this show, which is why you would make a move to have a travel ban that is going to be legally challenged when you don't have your legal team assembled. It's sort of a weird thing. It's almost like they got the public defender lawyer in that case, and that lawyer's like, I don't know what the was a travel ban, and they fired him, so fired her. So that's we'll find out more about what that means for the country, and also the hearing, which will be coming up, or the vote for Jeff Sessions, so that's coming up. Also tonight, coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, the 12th annual Barn Dance Apocalypse at Thalia Hall. It's coming up this weekend. The Golden Horse Ranch Band is warming up in the green room. It's pretty intense in there. There's a lot of fiddles. I'm not going to lie to you. I just walked in there. I was like, there's only one fiddle? Well, there's a lot of people that look like they've got fiddles. There's just a lot of fiddle-like instruments that are going on in the green room, but that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, my next guest are on the front line of Chicago comedy, two women breaking through at Second City, a place that's been in the news lately for staff changes and, well, sign changes, I guess, another reason in the news. Most of it at the heart of the changing political climate and a strange confidence for the audience to essentially shout out racist, misogynistic, and downright awful things at comedy shows. I guess that's the new thing. That's doing comedy in 2017. But the truth of the matter is that Chicago's Second City still reigns as a place that trains comedians who contribute to American entertainment. Joining me in studio, two stars from the current shows. Shantira Jackson grew up in Florida. She went to school at Florida State, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's currently starring in the main stage show Winner of Our Discontent. And Sejal Joshi. Did I get that right? Joshi?
You did. Congrats.
Grew up in North Carolina, and she stars in the Second City ETC show, Fantastic Super Great Nation, Numero Uno. Thanks for being here, you guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
So talk about, I mean, there's so much to talk to you guys about. Well, we'll get to sort of the idea of, you know, being on stage at Second City in 2017. But for both of you, you know, you've had different routes to the stages here in Chicago. Shantira, talk about growing up in Florida, going to school in Florida. How'd you end up at Second City?
I have a broadcast journalism background, and I was working at a news station. Sports are big in Tallahassee. Football is big in Florida, and I did a lot of sports broadcasting. And I found that I wasn't able to speak my truth in a way that I felt was comparable with what I learned in my school of journalism.
So it's just like stats and or like doing play-by-play, and you
that
couldn't...
and yeah, I just didn't feel like. I always felt like I was a storyteller, and I didn't feel like I was being honest with the stories I was telling. So I decided to look up places where I felt like I could be as honest and truthful as possible. And I looked up the Groundlings in L.A., and then I looked up Second City in Chicago. I have an aunt who lives in Beverly. I've never been to L.A., but I have been to visit my aunt. So then I moved here.
How these decisions are made, right?
That's how these decisions are made, yeah.
If you had an aunt in L.A., it would be a different story for you, right?
Probably, yeah.
Sejal, how about you?
I went to school for theater and was told I'd never get a job. So
great guidance counselor, first off.
I had horrible guidance counselors, actually. But I to be honest, I'm kind of glad that they weren't like, oh, yeah, you're going to be famous or get a job or whatever, whatever, because I think that's misleading as well. So I'm kind of glad that they kind of were the flip side of that. But yeah, I originally went to college to be a veterinarian. And then I decided I was going to try to be an actress, even after being told that no one ever gets to really do that. And so I dropped out of college.
Oh, no.
And then I moved back to Greensboro, North Carolina, which is kind of the middle of nowhere, but not really. There are more middle of nowhere places. And then I went back to school for theater and got a bachelor's in theater.
And then you came to Chicago.
I did. I toured with the Children's Theater Company, which is its own brand of weird, for like 4 months, and like lived in a van with like 6 other actors. And then we like ate out of a cooler because there was like no fridge or anything. And this is completely
that is
real.
Not my life.
This is super real. And I had it was the best 4 months of my life, though, because I was in my 20s. I didn't know any better. And I was like, this is so fun. And I got to see the United States, and I was paid $300 a week. And then the tour ended, and I didn't have any place to go. So, because my parents.
Ended up here.
Yeah, my parents had already moved back to India. And so then I was like, I guess I'll move to either New York or Chicago. And I was in a restaurant, and that Frank Sinatra Chicago song came on. And I was like, I should move to Chicago. And so then I packed up. I rented a car and packed it up with whatever I had
and
moved.
Shantira, you looked up Second City. And, you know, you, Sejal, you have been involved in theater.
Yeah.
But what did you know of Second City before? What was in the ether before you got here? What did you think of the company? What did you know of it?
I knew absolutely nothing about it. I didn't know anything about improv. I knew that I wanted to do what a lot of the people that I admired had come through here. So like Amy Poehler had come through here, and then Tina Fey, Tim Meadows, people that I really liked their writing and what they were doing, and they all started at Second City. So I took all of my graduation money, the last time anyone will pay you to do something you're supposed to do. I took all of my graduation money, and I came to Chicago for an immersion. They have a 1-week immersion in January. Where you can take writing classes, improv classes, music classes, whatever your heart desires. And I took all of my money and I bought a plane ticket. I bought a week's worth of writing classes and a week's worth of improv classes. And I said, if I like it, I'll move here. And if I don't like it, I'll go to grad school. That way I could procrastinate and no one will be disappointed in me.
What did you want to go to grad school for?
I was going to go to grad school for journalism.
Oh, okay.
I felt like I didn't feel like if I was doing it, I wasn't doing it the way I wanted to, but I could teach people to do it the way they wanted to.
Yeah.
So I was going to go and get a master's in that.
For both of you, I mean, theater, I mean, Second City is theater, but it's Genesis comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And for journal, I mean, it's not journalism, but it still makes points. I mean, it's something that tells stories. And so talk about how both of your upbringings have been adjusted to the Second City, to the idea of being on stage. As a broadcast journalist, as someone who went through school for that,
yeah,
it's similar in the way that even though it's in sketch and song and whatever, you still
very
are
so.
Explaining facts and making a point.
Yeah, I think that the universe prepares you in very interesting ways for things that you might not even see for yourself. Second City does social and political satire, very succinct jokes, precise amount of stage time to get your point across. Good journalist, you have a very succinct amount of words, a very precise amount of airtime. And then I learned how to tell jokes, so I was able to tell people some truth, but also make them laugh. So it's a great combination. Years and years of journalism worked out great for where I ended up.
Sejal, same question, I mean, about theater. I mean, the idea of having a background in theater does help when you have to be on stage, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 nights a week.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but I don't necessarily think of myself as that outgoing of a person. I'm kind of an extroverted introvert, so it actually is easier for me to be on stage than to be in like a group of like 10 people that I don't really know very well. That makes me way more nervous. Like when there's friends or family of mine in the audience, I'm just sweating because I'm so nervous. I care so much what they think. Whereas if it's a group of strangers, I'm kind of like, you know, this is my show. This is what you get. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. But then if like my boyfriend or my mom or something is there, I'm just like, oh my God, I'm going to die. I might not make it. I'm so, so nervous.
For sure.
It's crazy. But I think, I don't know how much my theater education prepared me necessarily. My college alumni paper interviewed me and they were like, what's a piece of advice you would give to a college student in theater? And I was like, drop out. And go do theater.
Do theater, and, don't study
and,
theater.
Yeah, right? And they were like, well, we can't print that. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
Even they can't print that.
Yeah, they didn't print it because they're, you know, they don't want to say anything. Not to say anything bad about my alma mater, but I think that, I don't know, I think it's more helpful to just be doing it than studying it necessarily. And I never studied comedy. I wanted to do Shakespeare and like serious stuff and maybe even musical theater, and no one would cast me for that stuff. Like they were like, no, we're never going to cast you as an ingenue, and we're never going to cast you necessarily as like a character actor because I was so young at the time. And so I kind of stumbled on improv. I was auditioning for everything, and I auditioned for an improv theater kind of by accident, and I was like, man, this is really cool and I love this. And it's called The Idiot Box. It's actually still there in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's an amazing comedy club. It's the coolest. And the people there taught me how to improvise. And that's kind of that's how I got into improv. I didn't do any improv in college or comedy, really.
Well, Sejal Joshi is with us. She's with the Second City ETC show, Fantastic, Super Great, Nation, Numero Uno. Shantira Jackson is with the main stage show, winner of Our Discontent. There is something I've always been enamored and admired people who are on the Second City stage, because as someone who has done comedy in my life, there is a tremendous amount of discipline that goes into being able to perform a show. Put aside writing and put aside the point of view, the idea that you have to hit a mark and say the same thing and do things that everyone has to rely on for a 2.5-hour show every single night. It's a training ground in becoming a professional performer. I mean, is that something that you guys think about, the idea that this is sort of that experience for you?
Well, I think that in a sense, it's kind of like a grad school, if you will, because I consider myself to be trained. Like, I wouldn't have gotten that job if I wasn't already a professional. I think there are ways that you can get there, and it can help. I did a cruise ship. Did you do a cruise ship, Sejal?
I did, yeah.
I did a cruise ship, Second City Works.
I did that after I toured, though. Yeah. I did it to get away from an ex-boyfriend.
As many people who go on...
That's real.
Many people who work on cruise ships go there after they have bad breakups.
Like, they have bad breakups and get a job on the Norwegian
cruise line? I was with this guy for 6 years, and he didn't want to marry me, and he still lives in Chicago. I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to...
Yeah,
I don't
want
to put him on
press.
Blast.
Don't give him the press.
Don't give him the press. But, yeah, and after that, I went up to... I emailed Beth and was like, can you please lose me at sea?
Yeah.
And she was like, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It's pretty crazy. It's
people do that. A lot of people
and we
do
could
that.
Do an hour on cruise ships.
Yeah.
Here.
Oh, that's another... That's a city. It's another world.
It's another world. But as far as... I did 11 shows a week for 4.5 months. So at the end, I had done 198 shows.
Wow.
So I... there's nothing else, I was ready.
It was your crucible.
Yeah, I was ready to go. So give me a job and I'll do it very well, especially in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, at least now I'm home.
Let me ask you, I just have a question about cruise ships because I've had friends who've done it. I mean, are you considered part of the crew?
No, not at all.
No.
Well, not our contracts.
No,
we had the best contracts on the ship.
Yeah, we are so contracted.
There are people on that ship that work 9-month contracts. Ours are usually 4. They send all their money home to their families.
Yeah.
They don't really ever get time off. They sleep in a room with, you know, 5 other people, 4 other people in bunk beds. Like, it is, our contracts were amazing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful opportunity
to
do that. As a comedian, especially most people who are actors spend the first 5 to 10 years grinding so hard.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that I had enough money and didn't have to pay rent was the coolest thing that had ever happened to me since I, like, lived with my parents and didn't have to pay rent. So, like, it was an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, it is a pretty amazing opportunity.
Okay, so let's talk about, I mean, both the shows that are on stage right now are new. I mean, the ETC show's brand new. The main stage show's been on for a couple months now. You talk about, I mean, this is the first shows of a Donald Trump administration. I mean, this is a new world order. You know, talk about how challenging it is, how easy it is. It's probably challenging to have this man be our president at a time when you have to create comedy around it.
Yeah. Well, also, we had there's a process that you go through. A show doesn't come up after a week. We work on the show for months. So we were working on the show pre-election.
During the election.
And there were parts of the show that were for a Hillary presidency. There were parts of the show that were for a Donald Trump presidency.
So you had to write two shows. Or two
essentially.
Bits at least. Yeah.
And we were waiting for the results because we couldn't predict it. And then once we got the results, we sat down and we talked and we decided what type of show we would be presenting. And then that's what we have.
And, Sejal, for you, your show came out a little bit after the fact, so this was all sort of written in a Trump world. You know, talk about, I mean, because there's stark differences. If you read the reviews, the review of the main stage show is much more biting about taking on
I don't think
Donald Trump.
There's very much, yeah.
And then in the ETC show, there's a little bit more like, well, it's a little gentler. I think the word gentle is used.
Yeah.
And is that by design? I mean, is it designed at Second City to have that sort of yin and yang?
The Second City does not decide it. I mean, we decided it.
Yeah.
The Second City is amazing about letting the actors and the actors/writers do their job. Mm-hmm. So day one, we were told, whatever you guys want to write, you can write that. We support you 100%. And so they had no say in what we
what our
created.
Content. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because they, when they hired us for the job, they were like, we're hiring you because we trust you as artists and we know you're going to do something amazing. And so that's, first of all, very fortunate because not a lot of jobs give you that kind of freedom.
Absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
Which is incredible. And secondly, we in the ETC also got very lucky because our first day of rehearsal was the day after the election. So we knew everything. So we had not done any process at all yet or any rehearsal or any writing or anything really before the election happened. So we were in a fortunate/unfortunate because of what happened, but in a fortunate position creatively to be able to know, okay, well, we're going to write something for the next potentially 6 months to a year based on what we know now. Like, we were kind of like, nothing, you know, this huge is probably going to happen
right
between now and when we open our show. So we didn't, I don't think it was as challenging as having to write a show and then retool everything.
Well, we had Chris Jones in, and Chris was, I don't even know if he was, the review he gave the show, the main stage
the
show.
The winner of our discontent.
Yeah. It wasn't even a review, it was an op-ed. It was more about the
he
sign.
He didn't talk about my art at all.
He did not talk about your art.
He didn't talk about my art, no.
But it was all about the sign. Second City had put a sign up that said, we will not tolerate heckling.
Any racism, sexism, xenophobia, homophobia.
So talk about that, because this is a change in that what Chris was talking about in the piece was just the idea that audiences have changed, yet does there need to be this sign?
This is what I'll say about the sign. The audience hasn't changed. The people on the stages have changed. So what we have now is an institution that's been around for 57 years. And for the first 35, they were straight white men. And this art was created by straight white men. And yes, and it's beautiful and it's wonderful, but it is not so wonderful for the marginalized. So now we have people of color, we have people who are homosexuals, and we have immigrants doing this art. And telling them that they have to say yes to everything can be detrimental, right? What we have now is an audience that's used to seeing the yesing of their own point of view, right? But I am not a white man. So the idea that my art would be specifically written to please you is a detriment not only to me, but also to you. So what I'll say about Chris Jones or any other reviewer is that if you're going to watch someone's art, it'd be nice for you to talk about how it made you feel as opposed to what the expectation of your feelings were.
Exactly, like the objectivity of the art that's on stage as opposed to it's...
Not what I expected.
The idea of juxtaposing against what came before.
Yeah, and that's the sign wasn't there before because drunk hecklers yelling something inappropriate to a white man is different from what they might yell to a black woman. And that's what we're getting, right?
Yeah.
You can't yell at something that you don't see. So there was no need for a sign before because to be rude to cis heterosexuals is different than being rude because it's not rude. It's racist, it's homophobic, and it's xenophobic. And that's why we got a sign, baby. That's why we got a sign.
Shantira Jackson, Sejal Joshi in studio with me tonight, both from Second City and the Main Stage Show, winner of Our Discontent, the ETC show, Fantastic Super Great Nation Numero Uno. You guys want
to
stick around?
Sure.
Do you mind if you don't have anywhere, you don't have a stage to hit in 15
Monday's
minutes?
My night off.
Monday's a night off.
Shantira,
I love it.
Came in here on her night off.
I love it.
Off.
All right. We'll take a break and then we'll get the update on tonight's news and we'll continue our conversation after the news.
Right on.
Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Shantira Jackson. She is currently starring in the Main Stage show at Second City, winner of Our Discontent. Also, Sejal Joshi. She is on Second City's ETC stage with the new show, Fantastic Super Great Nation Numero Uno. We're having a great conversation about what it means to be on stage at Second City in 2017, whether it be the political climate, but also about what audience... I don't want to say what audience, I guess maybe what audience expectations are. I mean, people are come in from all over the country to come to Second City, and they do think they're getting four white dudes. What is the formula? Four guys and
I
two.
I mean, it used to be 5-2, then it was 4-2, but we're switching it up a little bit now.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have four women and three men on our stage.
Let's talk about the transition at the stages, because it is interesting to me. One thing Chris Jones did talk about that resonated was this idea that, you know, for years, Second City here in Chicago has groomed an audience to come in that is almost a tourist audience. If you're concierge downtown, you're bringing people there, maybe from Iowa, other places. The content needs to be much more universal. It needs to be edgy, but not over the line. And his point was that Second City right now is in a transition where it has to be. Is it a show that is still for those audiences that come in? It might have a different political bent, might be different coming from the Midwest somewhere. Or is it a show that is for the people that are on stage, the artists, a more liberal-minded Chicagoan who has put this show together? What do you guys think about that?
I think it's both. I think that
think it's both as well.
I think that you can't write a show that's as truly honest from yourself as an artist only for other people. But I also think that as an artist, depending on what you're trying to put out there, if you're just writing it for yourself, then go write stand-up or go write a pilot, right? This is a collaborative art. And the expectation is that you'll be doing with a group of people, and then people will be coming to see something they don't expect. As a stand-up, you have a persona that is yours, and then when they come see you, if I go see Chris Rock, it's going to be different from if I go see Christopher Titus. I know exactly who they are, but this isn't a separate thing. So both.
Sage, do you want to?
I agree. I think we have a prime objective to make people laugh first and foremost, and I think if you violate that, then you've kind of violated what people have come there. They do have an expectation, I think. And I think partially we should uphold some of their expectation, obviously. But then also our job is to kind of, you know, ride that line of giving them something that maybe they weren't expecting. But we have to do it in a way that they're still receptive. So I feel like we do have, as performers and as generally very liberal performers, we obviously have our own points of view about things. And I feel like my greatest accomplishment is getting someone to understand my point of view without wanting to, you know, without being upset with me or without, you know, because once I get make someone upset, then they stop listening. And I don't ever want them to stop listening. So anything I can do to get them to keep listening, and generally that's make them laugh. So people are more likely to be receptive to things if you use humor. And that's the whole point of satire.
Well, Second City, it's interesting because you could see a point in which Second City could have a formula in which a show is run, and this is how it is, and you plug in, you sort of drag and drop people into it, and they come out. Second City has always protected the artists in the way that you guys write your own shows, you direct your own shows, you know you have directors that are involved with the ensemble, but there's a process as opposed to it being the show that's at Great America that's at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, Hall of Presidents kind of thing. I mean, you guys have the ability from show to show to be almost, you know, sort of autonomous and creative.
We're in a very unique position.
And the question, I guess, at the end of the day is, you know, when you think about that concept, because I think about Hollywood being almost the concept we're talking about. If you are a tremendous artist here in Chicago and you perform your material on stage and you make people laugh, you're going to grab the attention of people. They're going to be like, you're going to be great on Everybody Loves Kevin. You know, and you're gonna come on and you're gonna say the line that someone writes for you, and it is the drag and drop model for artists and for creativity. So there is a, I mean, there's a.
I think we struggle with that, definitely. Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, because then you think to yourself, well, maybe if I am on Everybody Loves Kevin, then eventually I'll get to write my own show. Like Mindy Kaling is a perfect example of that. I mean, she wrote for The Office for years and years, and now she gets to write her own show and say exactly what she wants to say. So you do kind of think to yourself. Sometimes I do have to think about, like, you know, winning specific battles, you know, picking your battles as opposed to fighting everything.
Right.
Like, I mean, yeah, we don't get to, you know, I do burlesque. I don't get to take my clothes off at Second City, you know, and so I'm not like, I'm going to take my, I don't care. I'm going to take my clothes off anywhere I want to take my, like, no, I don't, that's not
you
my.
You understand that doesn't fit on
that's
stage.
Not my objective there. Like, that's not, yeah, it's out of context. It's all, everything is about context. And, you know, I don't. No, personally, if I would want to be on Everybody Loves Kevin, I hear it's a great show.
It's a great show.
really, feels right.
But you understand my point. Right. You know what I mean?
Well, it's such a, I mean, for both of you to be on stage in Chicago, and as I said at the beginning of this segment, the idea that Second City has contributed so much to American entertainment, and I choose my words wisely there only for the fact that it doesn't mean that you automatically go to Saturday Night Live or you become the star of movies. There are so many people who have come through the Second City pipeline that are writers, that are producers, make a living, but you are informing and shaping American entertainment, even if we don't necessarily see your name all for, you know, the scroll at the end of the show.
Yeah.
So talk about, you know, where you're at right now as artists, but what's the end game for you? I mean, is the idea to continue to be creating in a way that you can make a living off of?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just to be where I am now, I'm so grateful. I'm an artist. Last January 2016, I was working four jobs and still trying to be an artist, right? I had four part-time jobs. Now I have one full-time job as an actor. There are people who don't get to do that until they're 50 or 60.
Or ever.
And they're good enough.
Right.
This is one of the few things where you can be good enough and still not get it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
If I want to be a cardiothoracic surgeon, I go to school, I go to med school and I learn all the things and I pass my boards and I'm a doctor, right? Cool. I could go to theater school and do every play and know all the Shakespeare in the whole world, and some dude might think I look like his ex-girlfriend and I won't get a job, right? So it's all about context in that way. But yes, I want to continue doing this. I think that I'm here and I'm doing it, but I think I would love to be able to write, especially as a Black woman. I think marginalized voices desperately need to be heard. And I could be on television. and say somebody else's words, or if I could put some of my words in someone else's mouth, that'd be great. I think it'd be really fun to flip that script. So that would be what my end goal is. But I didn't even know that this could be a job 8 years ago. So I don't know what specifically it might be.
Keep it open, right?
Yeah, keep it open. Because when I was 19, I didn't know that Second City was a thing. I also didn't know that that could be a job. So
Second City has, I mean, for years, the knock on Second City here in Chicago among liberal institutions was just the fact that there was no diversity.
Yeah.
It was just, like you mentioned earlier, white men, white men, white men. It was founded by, and it would, and the formulas are 5-2. There's nothing. But for both of you to be diverse talent that's coming through the pipeline and be at the stages you're at, main stage and ETC, what does that mean? I mean, do you look at where the company has come from for the idea that, you know, there's not a lot of people that you look on the walls of the lobby of Second City that look like you guys?
Yeah, I think that is for anything in America. I mean, I'll say this too. I walk into a room, I know immediately how many people who look like me are in the room. You grow up scanning, you grow up code switching. I won't explain what that is. If you want to know what it is, you can go look it up. But you grow up, I know exactly who I am and where I am at all times, right? So I didn't go in there expecting to see someone like me. I never really do. So if you go in with the expectation that you can do well in spite of there being no one who represents you doing it, well then, great. That's what I came in to do. And I'm fortunate enough that I get to be on that stage. Not for a second do I not think that I'm like incredibly blessed. Thousands of people move here every year to hopefully one day get the job that I have. I've never been more grateful to be an alumna of something that incredible. So I understand that for sure.
Sejal, how about you? I mean, you've been through Second City. You're a little bit different track than Shantir in the way that you've toured. You've done stage and done other shows, Second City theatrics and things of that nature. And now you're on stage at ETC. Talk about what that means for you as a performer and someone who has been a part of the Second City family.
I think it's really interesting because I kind of felt like that job was kind of like you do shows and you do things and you kind of are on a certain track in a way. And of course, everyone or most people want to do a stage because that's you get the chance to write and perform your own material, which you can't really do that anywhere else in Chicago. And so that's kind of the brass ring. And I think I was at a point kind of where I had already felt like that probably wasn't going to happen for me. And I think there was a trend of hiring young as well. And I'm older than I think everyone on both stages.
I think you might be.
Which I think is awesome.
More experience.
And yeah, and it's funny because people don't know how old I am, which
the
is
melanin, baby.
Kind of a riot. Yeah, exactly.
Helps.
Yeah, I have really good genes.
I'm 124.
You look really good.
Thank you.
So I feel like I had kind of already felt like that was not my path. And then a lot of stuff happened. I moved to New York for 5 months and all this stuff happened with the stages. And then I came back and I did a show, a collaboration with Lyric in Second City, which was incredible and so fun. And so I was like totally, I was actually in rehearsals for that when I got the call for ETC. And I thought they were going to ask me to go in as an understudy because everyone had left. And I didn't really want to do it because I really wanted to do my own material. And I do guitar comedy and stand up and burlesque and all this other stuff. And I was kind of super involved in other stuff and not really working as much in the building. And so it was actually a real big surprise to me when they offered me the job. And so, of course, I was like, yeah, I would love to do that. And so it's an interesting experience for me coming at it from almost like the other side of it. Yeah. I had already kind of been like, oh, that's not my path. And then it was very surprising to me. And so I did have to think about it for a minute and be like, oh, do I want to do this now? Because I feel like I had kind of like,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
like
I kind of
stopped thinking about it really.
Right, when you're not
and
thinking
so,
about it.
Yeah. And so then I found out, you know, who the cast was and the director. And
your cast is so great.
The cast is amazing and the director is amazing. And I was like, I can't give this opportunity up. I have to do this. And I asked some of my friends and my tipping point is 2. So if 2 people tell me to do something, I'll usually do it. So I asked, like, that's pretty low, right? Well, it has to be two really, it has to be two really good people,
influential
though.
Influential people.
It has to be two very personally influential, close people. And so two of my
texters to the radio station.
No, God, no. I mean, well, let's see what they got. No, but two of my very closest friends that I trust with my life were like, oh yeah, you have to do this. And with the political climate and everything, I was like, and it was funny because in my mind when I got the job, I was like, I'm going to get to write a show on the ETC with our first female president. Oh my God, that's going to be so cool. I was so excited when I got offered it that I was like, I can't wait to write stuff about Hillary and how cool this is. And this is such a moment in time. And I'm so lucky to be a woman on a stage when this is happening. And so that was my original mindset.
Get to throw out all that material.
But then when the other thing happened.
You're so lucky to be a woman on the stage when that happened, too.
I got to be honest. I felt like, I did feel like that. I was
Why
like.
Why so? Why? Just because.
Get to say something about it that lots and lots of people hear. Like that's, we have a megaphone.
Yeah.
And how cool is that?
Yeah, it's very important, I think, that we are on the stage when that happens.
It's incredible. And it just, I honestly couldn't have, it was like the planets aligned or something.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
It was incredible. I mean, I wish this wasn't the climate, but.
No, I think it's so wonderful. I also think that the idea that anybody would be surprised about how I feel about him being the president is absurd. So, like. For people to be like, I didn't come here and expect that. I was like, when's the last time you talked to a black person?
Well, I know our shows are different, and I feel like our audiences are, we actually have had very receptive audiences, and we have not, and I just remember thinking, one of the two people that told me to do the job, she's a mentor of mine. She actually owns a theater in Chicago. Can I plug her theater?
Sure.
It's amazing. It's Laugh Out Loud Theater. Her name is Lily Francis. They're amazing. Yeah. I've known her for like 10 years now. She's one of my best friends. She is one of the people that I ask the tough questions because she will always tell me the truth. And I asked her about it and she was like, you have to do it. And I mean, I don't think there was a chance I would say no, but I was kind of, I was like, I should talk to a couple people about this. And she told me one time when I first got hired by her at her theater that we are the smartest, funniest, best looking people in the room when we're on stage. And I really do believe that. And when audiences come in, if we ever have anyone who ever gives us any kind of a problem or anything like that, like it is our job to navigate that and handle that. And we are fully capable.
Most definitely.
And so I never felt scared or threatened or I feel like we can handle it, and we're trained to improvise, and so we're trained to talk to audiences and do crowd work and shut things down if we need to shut things down. And there shouldn't be, no one should feel afraid being on stage, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally agree with that.
There it is. Shantira Jackson, Sejal Joshi in studio right now. Shantira is on stage at the Main Stage Show, winner of Our Discontent. Sejal is on stage at the Second City ETC. Fantastic, super great nation, numero uno. Thanks you guys for coming in. I'd love to have you guys back, continue this conversation.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by what it, you know, just what you guys have to go through to put together a show in this political climate, but also be on stage and deal with not just the, you know, telling jokes, but the emotion behind
it. It's a unique animal, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. So thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Studio 435 coming up here in just a moment after the 10 o'clock news. We will have the live square dance stylings of the Golden Horse Ranch Band. They're warming up in the green room. This is going to be great. The 12th annual Barn Dance Apocalypse is happening this weekend at Thalia Hall. There are so many mics set up here. Bob is sweating. He's sweating. I've never seen him sweat. So many stringed instruments. So we'll have that coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour at the Golden Horse Ranch Band live in studio. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Now it's time for Studio 435, our weekly performance series, bringing you the best Chicago has to offer in our Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. If you're in the mood for a square dance, well, we got you covered tonight. Yeah. The 12th annual Barn Dance Apocalypse at Thalia Hall comes to you February 4th, and it's going to feature the band that's in studio tonight, the Golden Horse Ranch Band. The members, Lawrence Peters, Annie Coleman, Justin Brown, Janine O'Toole, Kip Rainey, Elise Bergman, and Greg Hurt are here. Lawrence Peters and Annie Coleman are sitting down with us before we start. Good to see you guys. Hey, Lawrence, hi. Good to see you. Have
hello,
you back.
Buddy.
Good to have you back. You were here before. All it right, was. So let's talk about the barn dance. I mean, this is something that when we say the, I mean, what you guys are doing at Thalia Hall is unique to that room. But talk about, I mean, Chicago has such a rich tradition, the Midwest does, when it comes to the concept of a barn dance.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of dancing going on in the 30s and the 40s here. And it was there actually was a square dance store over on Harlem Avenue. Oh, yeah. She passed away, but it was amazing. Which had so much rich history. There was a lot of dancing. And then it kind of got lost, like the rest of square dancing got lost in the 50s and 60s. Pretty much.
So but. Square dancing come. I mean, square dancing and the barn dance are one and the same. The idea that there was a barn dance and then square dancing would happen inside the barn dances. Am I reading that right?
Well, a barn dance was happened, you know, it's basically.
In a barn.
In a barn. And it was basically all the folk dances from Western Europe coming together. And a square dance caller or a caller came into being because they were doing all the dances differently. So a square dance caller is very unique to the folk dance of the U.S. because they were saying, okay, now we're going to Allemande left, which is a French term, and then we're going to swing your partner.
It's almost like a dance director in a way, a choreographer,
yeah.
Right?
Translator.
It was a translator and an assimilator, basically, a dance assimilator. So so a barn dance had a lot of different things. They would have square dances. They would have contra dances, you know, that were dances where the partners lined up facing each other. And they would have waltzes and polkas and things like that. And that's what we do. We do square dancing. We do contra dances. We do polkas.
Do you do the call?
Yeah, I do the call and teach the. And you don't have to know how to dance at all. All you have to know is how to have fun and want to have fun. And it's great. Like 500 people come together and we all dance and have a really great time.
Well, when it comes to Lawrence, I mean, you play a lot of different mm-hmm. sort of country music in Chicago and you play a lot of different places. But, you know, besides the apocalypse, the barn dance apocalypse at Thalia Hall, is it still a tradition that is done here in Chicago and in Chicago proper?
Annie probably has more experience than I do, but I know there are some other people doing square dances. I think there's actually isn't there like a Chicago square dance?
Yeah, there's Chicago Barn Dance.
Yeah, Chicago Barn Dance Association.
And through Old Town too. Yeah, they do some, but it's there's not tons of it happening.
No
barns.
No barns.
Lawrence, for you, I mean, you've so many different, you know, iterations of country music that you play. Where does the barn dance fit in? I mean, last time you were here, we were talking about sort of, you know, more classic country music. But talk about the folk music and what draws you to this kind of music.
Let's see. Yeah. So, yeah, usually the country stuff I'm interested in is like the honky tonk and that kind of stuff that's really structured in a particular way and is more songwriting oriented about, you know, the lyrics and the content and all that kind of stuff. But, the barn dance stuff, square dance stuff, especially it's really cool because it's a mixer. And so the whole tradition of you play music that people can dance to, and it's entirely expressly to get people to dance. And so the tempo is a certain way and the length of the song is a certain way and the people all come together and they're brought together in ways that they all have to get to know each other. Really cool. So you start off with one partner and then you go to another partner and then you go to another partner and then you go to another partner. So you meet everybody in the circle.
So there's actually like a social construct to it.
Yeah, it's a really old school social construct.
And that was the purpose of it was for people to meet each other, come off their farms and come together and meet each other and have fun.
And this was barn Tinder.
Well put, my friend. It was totally barn Tinder. Yeah, it's cool. And I'll tell you from standing up on stage and watching it. Let's see, I'm trying to think of how long I've been in the band. Like 9 years, 10 years, something like that. I wasn't in the first couple of years, but I was at the very first one, and it was remarkable, I got to tell you. But it's amazing standing on the stage and watching people dance. It's really cool.
Are people, I'm interested, Annie, Are people aware of that culture? I mean, are you playing to someone who's going to come to Thalia Hall and play? Are they like, I got my square dance pants on and I'm ready to rock and I've been waiting for this? Or is it sort of your run-of-the-mill Chicagoan who's like, I just kind of am into the music and I want to see what this is all about?
Well, you'll see some people that you're like, oh, they know how to dance.
Oh, yeah.
Like that they're triple twirling or something like that. But most people who come have never square danced before, or they've come every year to this and then they forget it every year and then they come back and they learn it again. And, you know, so it's like, and there's something very intuitive about it. It's like, as you go on it, there is something to these old dances and the intuitiveness of the movements. It's really interesting to watch because people, you can tell, are hesitant at first. And then once they start getting into it, it's really fun.
Well, I have to add that I think there's a fair number of people kind of in my age, you know, the 50s and a little bit younger than that, who took square dancing in school.
Yeah, right, I did.
Yeah. It was a pretty class. Common thing. Yeah. And probably in Illinois more than in other places, but in Denver and Kansas, like I knew a lot of people. I mean, everybody I knew took square dancing in school. I'm trying to think of what grade it was. Probably the most awkward one.
It was like a middle school.
It's the one where you don't want to actually
be like
10th doing
grade,
it.
Like 9th or 10th grade, and everybody was like, I'm so awkward.
It was not as awkward as aerobics. We had an aerobics class in high school that was like, the gym teacher was really into like 70s disco, like Rick James and things like that. So
aerobics.
But you're right. I totally forgot. I mean, I knew I had this like, this sort of, this feel for square dancing, and it's because it was part of the curriculum in my school in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So how did you get involved with Sandy? What is it about square dancing and barn dances that brought you to it?
Well, I never thought I'd be doing it here in Chicago, but my family had a dude ranch in the middle of Wisconsin called the Golden Horse Ranch, which is what the band's named after. And I grew up calling square dancing. So my grandfather started calling square dancing, and then when they bought the ranch in the 40s, and then my family did, and my brother and I started calling when we were kids, because it was a place where you would have activities at night. And so on Saturday night and on Thursday night, there was square dancing. So and it just and then I never thought, you know, because I didn't think, oh, I'm never gonna call square dancing again. But then I had some friends that like to go dancing, and so we'd go to all these different dance places, and I was like, I'm gonna surprise them with my crazy secret skills. And it was so fun to do as an adult. And then I ran into my another bandmate, and he had heard about the party. And so, and he was part of an underground warehouse space. And he's like, let's have a rogue square dance in this underground space. And we did some really stupid things. Like, we brought a bunch of hay in, which gave everybody allergies. And we made a bull out of a keg. And everybody fell off
terrifying.
And, like, bumped their head. But it was so much fun. It was, like, such a fun time. There's something about people coming together and dancing as a group. You know, we're used to, like, dancing alone, or you have to know how to dance, you know, like salsa or whatever.
Right.
The excitement of being able to all just kind of dance
and
together.
And do you rely, I mean, you think back to those memories you have as a kid of being a square dance caller. I mean, I'm interested in, I mean, how big of a town was Westfield, Wisconsin?
Yeah.
Like, how, I mean, who was coming to the square dance? Who was it just everybody from the town? That's what you did?
It was the guests at the ranch. It was a resort. So people would come for a week. It was like a Saturday to Saturday. You'd come for a week. And so it was just the guests that would come. And then some of our neighbors would come too. So, yeah.
So you gave them that experience.
Yeah.
I was going to say something too about the difference between square dancing and other stuff. I feel like regular dancing, like couple dancing or solo dancing has a tendency to be so self-conscious because it's all about you.
Yeah, right.
But with square dancing and reels and circle dances and line dances, it's a group effort. And so everybody's in it together. And I think it just takes away this whole level of anxiety and self-consciousness about dancing. It's so good.
And then we're really loud, so it's really fun.
So fun.
Well, and we play some non-traditional stuff, but in a country style that totally works.
Yeah.
And we, you know, Annie just constantly is coming up with cool dances to stuff. She'll be like, hey, let's do this thing. And, you know, we figure out the song to it and make it happen.
All right.
It's pretty rad.
The 12th annual Barn Dance Apocalypse. This is going to be at the Thalia Hall in Pilsen on February 4th. It's going to feature the Golden Horse Ranch Band. The members are in studio, Lawrence Peters and Annie Coleman. We're on mic here. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and then we got to hear some of this music, right? That's what you guys are here for. It's Studio 435 on the download. Stay with us. All right, it's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for Studio 435, where we bring the best of live performance from Chicago area bands here in our All-States Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. If you're in the mood to square dance, tonight is your night. The 12th annual Barn Dance Apocalypse is going to be at Thalia Hall this weekend, February 4th, featuring the Golden Horse Ranch Band, who are in studio. The members, Lawrence Peters, Annie Coleman, Justin Brown, Janine O'Toole, Kip Rainey, Elise Bergman, and Greg Hurt. What are we going to hear here, guys?
We hear a good old song called
Diggy Liggy Low. Diggy Liggy Low. Yeah. Here they are, the Golden Horse Ranch Band. Take it.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1.
Go there, the Golden Horse Ranch Band in studio tonight. Lawrence Peters, Annie Coleman, Justin Brown, Janine O'Toole, Kip Rainey, and Elise Bergman, and Greg Hurt. They are going to be at the 12th annual Barn Dance Apocalypse at Thalia Hall, coming up here on February 4th. Trent, why don't you guys come on back to the table, and then we'll do a song after the break because we're kind of tight on time here. But as I hear that song, what's the dance that's accompanying with it? I mean, is there a specific dance?
Yeah, it's really a two-step.
Okay.
That's a two-step.
So we teach them how to two-step or two-step light.
Two-step light.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
Is there
a tremendous amount of lead-up? Like, do you have to sit there and do a lesson for a half hour before you? Like...
Well, not for that one so much. That is kind of a loose, mm-hmm. just go nuts and do
just
your thing.
Just go nuts.
But the other stuff, like when Annie teaches you how to do the Western Star?
All the other dances.
What's the star one?
Texas Star.
Texas Star.
I've learned how to be very efficient with my teaching.
Yeah, she's good.
So get them going, get them out there.
Mm-hmm. And then would you be doing square dance calling in a song like that? Like, what would you be doing?
Not in that one. I wouldn't call square dance in that, but we have other ones that I call square dances with, and we've matched up the squares to the songs, so... It's really fun.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so fun.
Yeah.
The 12th annual Barn Dance Apocalypse is going to be at Thalia Hall coming up on Feb 4. The Golden Horse Ranch Band is in studio tonight.
Yeah, man.
Woohoo! We got more to. We're going to hear some more live music. We'll take a break, and we will come back. And we'll, you know, we'll come back, and we'll get some more. And I mean, is there any way to get? Will you do any calling as part of the songs?
I mean, I will if you want. We could do a little call. Sure.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Don't we all want to hear that?
Yeah.
I think I want to hear that.
Yeah.
If it's too much of a pain in the butt. I mean, it's just me and Bob in here.
We'll talk amongst ourselves during
the
break.
There you go. There you go. So we got about a minute and a half, which is good. So we can talk a little bit more.
Cool.
All right. So, so what would it take? I mean, what would a call consist of? I mean, is it the band playing certain instrumental music and then you just saying, now left and right?
Yeah. I mean, can you guys play Head to Gents?
Or, sure.
Okay. I can just call.
Yeah, let's do it real quick. Yeah. You can play it in the back, yeah.
Well, head to Gents crossover and buy your opposite sand. Side to Gents crossover, now you all join hands. Bow to your corner lady and on your partners all. Well, swing your corner lady and you promenade the hall.
Promenade!
Okay. If I had a girl and she wouldn't dance, I'd tell you what I'd do. I'd buy her a boat and send her afloat and paddle my own canoe.
That's great. All right, good. Good stuff, good stuff. That's great. That was great. See, an impromptu call. We did it, Bob.
What? And I have to point
on
out
that Michigan
there's,
Avenue.
There's a little, there's always a little sexual innuendo in the old square dances.
Yeah.
Paddle my own canoe.
I didn't pick it up, but I'm glad you pointed it out. Yeah, Lawrence Peters gets all the sexual innuendo out.
That's all about.
It's all about. All right, more with the Golden Horse Ranch Band. Welcome back. Thanks, Veronica. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. What a fun night in Studio 435. The amazing sound of the Golden Horse Ranch Band. They're playing at the 12th Annual Barn Dance Apocalypse at Thalia Hall on February 4th, this Saturday. The members in studio, Lawrence Peters, Annie Coleman, Justin Brown, Janine O'Toole, Kip Rainey, Elise Bergman, and Greg Hurt. We've got, what do we got? Fiddle. We've got a little steel drum there. We've got a guitar. We can sing in. Mandolin. The steel, still look at that. Oh, little slide steel there. The upright bass. Ooh, what are we going to hear here?
It's Jukebox Blues.
Jukebox Blues. 720 WGN, take it.
Jukebox ran away. And I heard something going.
some good stuff. Golden Horse Ranch Band in studio. They'll be performing at the 12th Annual Barn Dance Apocalypse at Thalia Hall on February 4th here in Chicago and Pilsen. The members, Lawrence Peters, Annie Coleman, Justin Brown, Janine O'Toole, Kip Rainey, Elise Bergman, and Greg Hurt. You know what? Let's just keep this. Let's keep the groove going. What do you guys? Let's play another one. What do you got?
We're going to do a Loretta Lynn and Conway Twitty song.
Oh.
You're the reason our kids are ugly.
You're the reason our kids are ugly here on 720 WGN. Studio 435. Take it.
One, two, three, four. You're the reason I'm riding around on recap tires.
You're the reason I'm hanging all our clothes outside on wires.
You're the reason our kids are ugly, little darling. Oh, but looks ain't everything. Money ain't everything. I'm gonna love you just the same.
You're the reason I changed the beer from soda pop.
You're the reason I never get to go to the beauty shop.
You're the reason our kids are ugly, little darling. All the looks ain't everything. Money ain't everything. But I love you just the same. Guess that we won't ever have everything we need. 'Cause when we get ahead, it's got another mouth to feed.
Ranch Band in Studio 435 tonight. The members, Lawrence Peters, Annie Coleman, Justin Brown, Janine O'Toole, Kip Rainey, and Elise Bergman, Greg Hurt. They're going to be playing at the 12th Annual Barn Dance Apocalypse at Thalia Hall coming up on February 4th. Thalia Hall, of course, down in Pilsen. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk some more, a little bit about square dancing, barn dancing, and then get our last tune. Sound good? It's a download here on 720. Stay with us. Studio 435 here on 720 WGN, the download. I'm Justin Kaufman.
Woo.
The Golden Horse Ranch Band in studio, the 12th Annual Barn Dance Apocalypse at Thalia Hall on February 4th. Members of the band in studio, Lawrence Peters, Annie Coleman, Justin Brown, Janine O'Toole, Kip Rainey, Elise Bergman, Greg Hurt. A texter just texted in at 224 says, tonight you're sounding just like 1940s WLS Barn Dance. Chicago
nice.
Does. It does have a connection.
Chicago remembers.
She remembers. But this is a big, I mean, as much as barn dances are known throughout the Midwest and rural areas, Chicago does play, has a major part of it, the
major
barn dance
part.
History. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and it had a big, we talked about this last time I was here, that Chicago has a big country music history in general.
And you usually think of the South when you think of country music, but there's a lot of country music that was happening
because all
here.
Them Southern folks came here and worked in the factories.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, Cowboy Sweetheart was written here when
That's right.
when Patsy Montana went to the barn dance and performed at the barn dance, supposedly she wrote Cowboy Sweetheart, which is a huge hit
here
downtown in Chicago somewhere in a hotel.
Yeah,
that's right.
And Girls of the Golden West. Yeah. Also, they were a big deal.
You guys know your country music, your connections. You told these stories before, but it is. I mean, the barn dance, because it was, you know, AM radio at the time, mm-hmm. and there's so many different people relied on the big cities for radio, and you could get it in different places. You know, stations like GN and LS did barn dances, and they were broadcast huge. I forgot who was our guest on the show, and it may have been Langford. I forgot who was talking about
that guy.
That the idea that because they were doing that, it's almost interesting that Nashville at the time, it wasn't always the capital of country music. Chicago was, and where it was, and because we were broadcasting out, Nashville's like, hey, we want to do that. And that's sort of how Nashville became the country music capital of the world. There you go. See?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I know. Good job, buddy.
I know some.
Yeah. Way to go, Justin.
Chicago proud.
Yeah, those cue cards are working out.
They're really good. A lot of Pete's in my ear. He's giving me all this stuff. I'm like an old Tom Brokaw. Yeah. Young Tom Brokaw. Okay, so, you know, what can we expect at this barn dance? If let's say people are listening right now and they're like, I haven't been to a barn dance since I was younger. I want to go out. I've always wanted to do that. What can we expect from the barn dance apocalypse at Thalia Hall?
Sure. Well, you don't need to bring a partner. You can bring a bunch of friends. You can come by yourself. Everybody's welcome. Get gussied up. Mm-hmm. People, I mean, this is your time to get gussied up. You know, you're going to a dance on a Saturday night. And people do. But any way you want. You can get gussied up any way you want. And we always have a local artist design a beautiful photo op booth that's usually country themed. And then this year it's Jennifer Friedrich, who is a puppeteer here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And then we have a photographer, a professional photographer, Justin Schmitz. He does the photos. And so you get to take a photo as well. And then, you know, you're going to basically dance until you drop and you're going to feel great the next day. And you're going to be like, mm-hmm. I had a really productive Saturday night. Mm-hmm. I feel great. I danced. I met people. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have made really lasting friendships through this dance.
Well, we've played weddings of people that met at the Square Dance.
Yeah, that's true. Ooh, it's true.
Many.
How much is the barn dance apocalypse, which is this Saturday, how much of it is a nostalgia trip and how much of it is sort of a hybrid, its own thing?
I wouldn't call it a nostalgia trip at all. Honestly, it's such a it's Americana, I guess, more than anything. It's a part of our culture. It's something that everybody can participate in. It's, you know, it's influenced by everybody. It's a really perfect melting pot kind of thing. It's like what Annie was saying earlier about the caller interpreting all the different dances from all the different cultures, like all that stuff got brought in, you know, mm-hmm. and so it's still in there.
We don't try to be like old timey or of a different era. I mean, we play country music, but we also do stuff like we interpreted Sweet Child of Mine, you know, by Guns N' Roses, because mm-hmm. of course, you know, so stuff from our, you know, time period. And mm-hmm. I think maybe because I grew up calling it, that it isn't like something, you know, it's just some. We all have a connection to it in some way, I guess. So.
Well, and my old singing partner, Kelly Kessler, had this great way of putting this exact thing years ago. She said something about how like country music is like a tree, and there's like the big branches that keep growing and are the really obvious ones, but there are other branches that are maybe a little mm-hmm. less seen. And the thing is that it's all still part of the same thing. It's all alive.
Yeah,
and
right.
So there's, you know, like there's top 40 country stuff, but then there's this is our version of all these different eras of this music and this dancing, and we bring in new songs and new material and we make it all works because we feel it.
Up.
Yeah. And it all comes from the same place, and so it equals the same thing, but it's not like some museum piece.
Yeah. I think of country music and you mentioned with the top 40 and what we see in the Country Music Awards mm-hmm. and contemporary country music,
yeah.
but as its form, as I hear this music, I mean, just like the listener called in and said, or texted in saying, this reminds me of 1940s WLS mm-hmm. barn dance.
Nice.
What has been the growth or experimentation of this kind of country music over the years? Has it changed in format, or are the new writers of a little bit more of this style, this barn dance kind of square dance style of music? Do they stick to the traditional style?
I don't know if there's really like an active writing, like songwriting component to this. I don't feel like, I might be wrong, but I don't really feel like it's something that people are necessarily writing. I mean, people write there are plenty of bands, and there's a lot of really good local bands that do like string band music mm-hmm. and bluegrass music, and right. that's very much part of this kind of thing. And this, there's new stuff that's written in that context, but I personally don't think of barn dances as having a like. You know, like I'm writing some barn dances.
A young singer songwriter,
square dances
protege who's just like right. blowing the minds of barn dances everywhere. Yeah. That's not happening.
No.
Maybe in the callers. Let me.
I mean, we make up new dances and we make up new. You know, but it's really not about that. It's about like if we're a dance band. You know, we're nothing if there's no dancers. It's not really about you know mm-hmm. us being like, look at this amazing new song. Kind of, but not really.
Well, there's such a tradition of dance bands in popular music, or just any music sure. in general. I mean, you see from the bands that play at house bands and jazz clubs or blues clubs or what you see even, you know, I was thinking of late 70s, like I was talking about, like the Rick James type music. But the bands that have almost morphed into playing Earth, Wind & Fire at weddings and things like that. There is a tradition in America of the dance band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to make true. Everybody feel good and you want to make the dancers dance. There's nothing a dance band loves more than a room full of dancers mm-hmm. dancing and having fun, because you can feel it. Like we can feel like we're going back and forth and we're all doing it together. It really feels great.
As a veteran caller,
yes.
do you get upset when the dancers are just totally messing it up?
No, I've learned to go with soft focus.
I have to not
and
watch.
Sometimes I just give up. I mean, I just, you know, sometimes people have drunk a little too much or something, and, you know, they go off. But, as long as everybody's having fun,
no,
it doesn't
you're okay.
matter.
You don't stop the music?
No.
Whoa, I said left.
No, not at all.
I do.
That's right.
I can't watch. The Virginia Reel, I can't watch because I remember early on I was really invested in these people getting it right, and I remember it actually almost dropped a beat. Because I was like, to compensate, because I was like, no, they're off. Oh, I'm up here. It doesn't have anything to do with me. Shut your eyes, Lawrence.
Well, that's you as a controlling drummer.
That's true.
Yeah.
Those drummers are so controlling.
Seriously.
Well, the 12th annual Barn Dance Apocalypse is at Thalia Hall this weekend, February 4th, featuring the Golden Horse Ranch Band, who's in studio 435 tonight. You guys got one more in you, right?
We do.
Oh, yeah. What are we going to hear here?
We're going to do Y'all Come.
Yeah, it's an old Carter Family song. All and it's right. a polka.
Oh. Can I say a quick...
You can polka at home if you want
let
to.
Let me say a quick thank you to Elise for sitting in with us tonight. She's actually in one of those bands that I referenced earlier that are doing, you know, string stuff and bluegrass stuff. She's in Big Sadie, and they're righteous.
And who are you in for? Who's Elise in for?
Thanks for the shout-out.
Hell yeah.
Who's Elise in for?
She's sitting in for Mr. Anthony Burton, who is the other half of the originator. I mean, it's all Annie's show, but he was an early... All right. Part of this whole shindig.
All right. Lawrence Peters, Annie Coleman, Justin Brown, Janine O'Toole, Kip Rainey, Elise Bergman, and Greg Hurt live in studio 435. Are you guys ready to rock?
Yeah.
Bob's setting up a microphone here real quick. And then I think we're ready to put on a show for Michigan Avenue. All right. They're at a stoplight quick. All right. Take it away.
One, two. By and by.
Oh, I love it. Golden Horse Ranch Band in studio. The 12th annual Barn Dance Apocalypse is going to be at Thalia Hall Saturday at February 4th. The members of the Golden Horse Ranch Band in studio tonight, Lawrence Peters, Annie Coleman, Justin Brown, Janine O'Toole, Kip Rainey, Elise Bergman, and Greg Hurt. Good luck with the show, and thank you guys so much for being my guest tonight in Studio 435.
Thanks, Bob, for making it all sound good.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks, Peter.
She's real. She's Chicago. She's Robin Baumgartner. Watch the Robin and the rest of the WGN Morning News team. Weekdays 4 to 10 on Chicago's very own WGN TV. That's going to do it for us tonight here on the Download, 720 WGN. We're in for about an hour or so tomorrow before the Blackhawks play. They got a late game tomorrow night, so we will be in for a bit. And we've got great shows coming up this week. We've got a Northwestern Wildcats game as well, the game against Purdue, which I think is on Wednesday, right? That's going to be a big deal. Patty Vasquez coming up next. Brian Altimer sitting in, too. That's going to be fun. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com.